season. To start the series, we'll be joined by the saxophonist Jess Gillam and the songwriter Richard Stilgo.
This is about dreams. This is about what you can do when the music takes you somewhere.
The new series of Add to Playlist on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Starts tomorrow evening at 7:15.
Good morning. It is 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 21st of November. Good to be with you. Good to have your company. This is Today with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett.
The headlines today. The former Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott, who played a crucial role in the Labour governments led by Tony Blair, has died at the age of 86. We will speak to Sir Tony Blair and Gordon Brown about Lord Prescott's contribution to national life, both in office and in reforming the Labour Party in the 1990s.
There's no doubt this man, our leader, put his head on the block by saying, basically, I fervently believe, because that's what he believes, of a relationship and a strong one with the trade unions and the Labour Party. He's put his head there. Now's our time to vote. Give us a bit of trust and let's have this vote support.
We'll also have some reminders of John Prescott's many signature appearances here on Today.
You're a programme of depression at the moment. When I listen to your programme, and Evan, you come on, you're always predicting the misery, the end of the world. Gordon Brown's no gone. You've been bloody wrong all the time and you'll be wrong again.
There you go. The other main news today. The Australian Parliament has begun debating legislation which would ban under-16s from accessing social media platforms such as Instagram and TikTok. We'll be getting into that. And also in today's programme, should dogs be banned off leads in parks? I can imagine there will be quite a response. We shall discuss. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
The former Deputy Prime Minister, Lord Prescott, who was a major figure in the Labour Party for decades, has died at the age of 86. He'd had a stroke in 2019 and his family said he'd been living with Alzheimer's. John Prescott was an important bridge between Labour's traditional left wing in the trade union movement and the modernising faction of the party. Our political correspondent Ben Wright looks back at his life.
As the Labour Party modernised under John Smith and Tony Blair, John Prescott was a proud working class bridge to its past. A former ship steward, he had deep roots in the trade union movement.
I came out of 10 years of seafaring that taught me all the industrial strength and the industrial muscle, couldn't achieve all that I wanted, that I needed a political party to make the changes to achieve the...
In office, Blair valued his deputy's loyalty, and John Prescott played a key role mediating the fractious relationship between the Prime Minister and his Chancellor Gordon Brown.
He has got very, very great strength.
John is John. That was Tony Blair's affectionately rueful reaction when his deputy punched an egg-throwing protester during the 2001 general election. It cemented John Prescott's reputation as a no-nonsense political bruiser. Following Labour's landslide in 1997, Prescott ran a huge department that spanned transport, planning and the environment. He played a key role setting up the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. Famously fond of his Jaguar cars, the man dubbed Two Jags in office revealed he had ditched them when he appeared at the COP climate summit in 2021. John Prescott's contortions with the English language were often mocked by a press he seemed to loathe, but he brought colour and conviction to the new Labour Party.
The Defence Secretary John Healey will be questioned by MPs today after it emerged that Ukraine had fired British-supplied missiles into Russia for the first time. The government has so far not commented to confirm or deny the use of the weapons. The US has allowed Ukraine to use missiles it has supplied to hit targets in Russia and has now approved almost $300 million of further military aid. Peter Bowes reports.
The package includes ammunition, missiles, drones and an undisclosed number of anti-personnel landmines, a move which has been criticised by activists because of the danger they pose to civilians, although US officials insist the devices contain safety features. The latest military aid is part of a surge in security assistance announced by President Biden in September, which the State Department says is urgently needed by Ukraine to defend itself and succeed on the battlefield. Washington has also recently permitted Kyiv to use US-made ballistic missiles against Russia.
A BBC investigation has found thousands of pounds worth of British mini-computers, which were designed to teach children coding, have been shipped to Russian companies sanctioned for their links to the military. Raspberry Pi circuit boards have been discovered in drones used against Ukraine. The company says it was not involved in the trades and is doing all it can to stop them. A highly critical report by the Charity Commission has said the family of Captain Sir Tom Moore received almost £1.5 million from a book deal, but repeatedly refused to give any of it to the foundation set up in his name. The war veteran raised money for the NHS during lockdown by walking laps of his garden. Here's our investigations correspondent, Joe Pike.
Captain Sir Tom Moore raised £39 million, which all went to NHS charities. But it's the actions of his daughter Hannah and her husband Colin which the Charity Commission has said amounts to misconduct, mismanagement or both. It said they repeatedly personally benefited from the charity that was set up in his name, including the money from a deal for three books. The publisher and promoter of those books said the family gave repeated assurances that part of the advance would be used to set up and fund the Captain Tom Foundation. The charity has yet to receive any of it. The Ingramores have said this report has treated them unfairly, the process was unjust and excessive, and the Charity Commission had a predetermined agenda.
There's been a surge in the rate at which children are being suspended or excluded permanently from state primary schools in England. The BBC analysed data from the last 10 years and found that suspensions had more than doubled, while exclusions had risen by 70%. Last year, there were 84,000 suspensions compared with 38,000 a decade ago. Here's our education correspondent, Elaine Dunkley.
The most common reason for a primary school pupil being suspended or excluded was persistent disruptive behaviour. More than 90% of those permanently excluded in the past 5 years also had special educational needs and disabilities. Teaching unions are warning that a shortage of funding, a lack of support for pupils with special educational needs, and long waiting lists for speech and language therapists are leading to an increase in disruptive behaviour among primary school children. The Department for Education says the surge in suspensions and permanent exclusions was left to spiral out of control, and it will invest £1 billion into special educational needs and will go further to support pupils and teachers.
Australia has introduced legislation to ban those under 16 years of age from accessing social media. The Communications Minister told Parliament it was a world-first bill that would protect young people. Apps such as Instagram and TikTok will be made to ensure compliance and will be fined if they fail. But Daniel Angus, a professor in digital communication at the Queensland University of Technology, says even if the law passes, it won't work.
We need to protect children within the digital environment. We should not be excluding them from the digital environment. When you try and censor or block parts of the internet fights back. It is an incredibly resilient infrastructure that will resist this form of blockage, and children are incredibly savvy and entrepreneurial, and they will find a way around this ban.
The US government has asked the courts to order the dismantling of Google by making it sell its Chrome browser. The Department of Justice has set out a series of measures, including banning deals for Google to be the default search engine on smartphones and preventing it from exploiting its Android mobile operating system. The company is expected to set out its counter-proposal next month ahead of a court hearing in April.
Jane, thank you very much. It's 8 minutes past six. Let's get the latest on the weather, which has been rather chilly, with Simon King at the BBC Weather Centre. A slight understatement there, but it's good to do. Carry on. You tell us the real deal, Simon. Morning.
Slightly chilly, yeah. Pretty cold, Emma, actually. Temperatures this morning down to -4 to -8 degrees across many northern areas, actually. -10 Celsius in Scotland at the moment. And further wintry hazards in the forecast. So for southwest and southeast England, it's a frosty start for many. And we've got some rain in southwest England, which is turning to snow at the moment across the moors and tors of the southwest. We could see as much as 10 to 15 centimetres of snow here throughout the day. Down at low levels, it's more complicated. A mixture of rain and some sleet and maybe a small covering of snow in one or two places can be ruled out. Now, this wintry mix of rain, sleet and hill snow will move its way further eastward along the south coast in towards parts of West Sussex. It's also very windy in the southwest with some gales, if not severe gales. A bit of sunshine elsewhere. Temperatures are 1 to 4 Celsius. For Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, again, yeah, frosty and pretty icy to start off with. It's going to be dry for most of the day, though, with actually some sunshine, although a bit of rain and some hill snow brushes into South Wales at times, and a few wintry showers also across North Wales, temperatures of 1 to 3 degrees. Across northern England, cold and frosty, dry, though, with lots of sunshine expected today, temperatures of 2 to 5 degrees. And for Scotland and Northern Ireland, frequent snow showers piling into northwest Scotland, significant accumulations over higher ground, especially icy, of course, as well. We'll see a few wintry showers coming into Northern Ireland. Otherwise, it's dry with some sunny spells and temperatures of 1 to 4 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. 9 minutes past six. Let's have a first look at what's in this morning's newspapers and what's on the websites. And, of course, the papers went to the printers before the news broke, which it did about 10 minutes ago here and elsewhere, that John Prescott, Lord Prescott, has died at the age of 86, former Deputy Prime Minister, absolutely key figure in the new Labour era and beyond. He's died. We're going to be speaking to Tony Blair on this programme and also to Gordon Brown. That's the story across most UK news websites now. Let's tell you a little bit about what's in the front pages of the papers. The Times describes the first use by Ukraine of British-made Storm Shadow missiles on targets inside Russia as a marked intensification of UK involvement in the conflict. The paper's front page has a grainy photograph which it says shows a command post in the Kursk region, that's in western Russia, being hit. It argues that the move and the use of American so-called ATACMS missiles shows Moscow that Ukraine's western allies remain determined to supply Kyiv with the systems necessary to defend the country.
UK defies Putin is the headline for the I newspaper. In an analysis piece, it suggests that the use of the missiles is a bold, dangerous stroke intended to break the spine of Russia's operations inside Ukraine. It mentions President Putin's recent threat to retaliate with nuclear weapons if Russian sovereignty was threatened with arms supplied by the West. But it suggests that the prospect of Donald Trump returning to the White House may have persuaded governments that Moscow would be less likely to launch weapons of mass destruction.
The Daily Telegraph is concerned that these Storm Shadow missile strikes have happened when the British military is facing £500 million worth of cuts. Its leader argues that plans to phase out the Army's primary drone system, along with several Navy ships and older RAF helicopters, are madness at a time of heightened global tensions.
The Mail agrees, suggesting in its opinion column that the move announced yesterday by the Defence Secretary John Healey will leave a gaping hole in Britain's ability to project power when we are at the forefront of a global fight for freedom.
There's a picture on the front page of the Financial Times of a Chinese bulk carrier ship, which has been closely monitored by a Danish military patrol vessel, days after two fibre optic data cables in the Baltic Sea were severed. The paper says shipping data suggests that the Yi Peng 3 was in the area when the cables were damaged. Swedish police say they're also interested in the ship. China says it always requires its vessels to abide by relevant laws and regulations.
The Guardian reports that the Labour MP, Diane Abbott, has joined forces with the Conservative, Sir Edward Lee, to express concern about the assisted dying bill. There's due to be a free vote in the Commons on the measure, which would allow terminally ill people to end their lives in certain circumstances. That's happening a week on Friday, and we've been hearing how various ministers will or will not vote, if they're able to say that, again, a source of contention. But Miss Abbott and Sir Edward, the mother and father of the House of Commons, argue that there's been insufficient scrutiny of the bill. They want Parliament to focus instead on better health and care services.
Several front pages concentrate on the funeral of the pop star Liam Payne. The Sun has photos of his former One Direction bandmates and his ex-partner Cheryl at the ceremony. The headline is All for One. The Mirror's is simply Farewell Liam. In its opinion column, The Express concludes that the dignity of Liam Payne's funeral was a reminder that beneath the show business glamour, he was also a beloved friend, son and father.
It's 13 minutes past six.
Let's turn to school exclusions. You may have heard in the bulletin at the top of this hour, Elaine Dunkley, our education correspondent, explaining that the rate at which primary schools are being suspended from state schools in England has more than doubled in a decade. That's according to our BBC analysis. And Elaine is on the line now. Elaine, morning.
Morning.
Why has this happened, do we think?
Well, exclusions are increasing at a faster rate in primary schools compared to secondary schools. One of the biggest factors in this surge is that more than 90% of those children permanently excluded from primary over the last 5 years also had special educational needs and disabilities. Now, we know there is a shortage of educational psychologists. We know children are waiting for years for assessments for autism diagnosis and ADHD. And we know there aren't enough places at special schools. Now, if we add that to the pressures teachers are under, class sizes, big workloads, safeguarding concerns, it becomes clear that there is a problem in a lot of mainstream schools. So what we end up with is children and families desperately needing support on one hand, and on the other we have teachers unable to cope. And this is the background to an increasing number of children being suspended and excluded. And primary children aged five now would have been 1 year old when the pandemic started. Speech and language has been a huge issue. A lot of children are behind and can't get access to speech and language therapists. And so what we have is children who are unable to communicate, who are struggling, and this can lead to disruptive behaviour and frustrations. The other major driver in this is poverty. As well as the pandemic, there's been a cost of living crisis, and research shows that children from poorer backgrounds are disproportionately affected by exclusions and suspensions. 70% of pupils excluded or suspended from primary schools were also eligible for free school meals. Now, unpicking the reasons as to why a child ends up being excluded at primary school is difficult, and often it's not just one thing. There's trauma, it can be parenting, discrimination based on ethnicity, a lack of support in schools can also be a factor. But what is clear, is that the long-term impacts of this is worrying. So 91% of children permanently excluded in primary school didn't pass their GCSEs in maths and English, and almost two-thirds of those excluded were persistently absent by the time they reached year 10.
Okay, it does sound like an interesting cocktail or mixture of factors. We're coming back to this story at 8:30, but for now, Elaine Dunkley, our education correspondent, thank you very much indeed.
It's 6:15. The BBC understands that Ukraine has fired UK-supplied long-range Storm Shadow missiles at targets within Russia for the first time. The UK government is not commenting on the reports, but the Defence Secretary John Healey will face questions from MPs on this today. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has announced a new package of military assistance for Ukraine worth more than £200 million. Paul Adams, our correspondent who's in Dnipro in Ukraine this morning, joins us now. Paul, what can we say first of all about these long-range missiles, certainly from the UK perspective?
Well, they are missiles that the Ukrainians have had for quite some time. In fact, they were used to devastating effect against the Black Sea Fleet in Crimea more than a year ago. But this is the first time that they have been used across the border inside Russia. Ukraine doesn't have a huge number of them. It'll be choosing its targets extremely carefully. We don't know exactly what was hit yesterday, but there was certainly a significant series of explosions. It's almost certainly all about trying to prevent Russia from being able to organize a counteroffensive to remove Ukraine's forces who are currently occupying that small sliver of territory inside Russia in the Kursk region. That counteroffensive has been expected for some time. Of course, we know about the arrival of 10,000 troops from North Korea. And I think both the Biden decision on the use of ATACMS longer-range missiles and the Storm Shadow decision, both of these are all about trying to enable Ukraine to hold on to that bit of territory, possibly as some kind of bargaining chip for the future.
And we just mentioned there about the new package of military assistance from the Biden administration. It does feel in the last week alone, and actually as the war hits its 1,000th day, rather, that there has been, I don't know if you'd call it an intensification, an escalation. How would you describe how it's been over the past few days with these various insights and announcements?
Well, I can tell you how it feels in the last 3 hours, because if I sound at all groggy, it's because we've been up since about 5:15 as a result of a series of explosions in the sky over Dnipro, which began quite early on and went on for about 3 hours. Pretty intense series of attacks. We're not quite sure what's been hit. I think there have been some targets hit here in the city, but most of it, I think, was intercepted as usual. But yes, I think there is a belief that among Ukraine's allies, particularly in Britain, Germany and the United States, that everything needs to be done to try and allow Ukraine to weather the storm that it is currently facing, and to put Ukraine in the strongest possible position come the end of January, when, of course, Donald Trump takes over in the White House, and no one really knows what that means for U.S. policy beyond this rather general notion of being able to solve the war in a matter of 24 hours. So the Americans talk about shoveling aid out through the door. This latest package of $275 million worth of equipment is part of that. Yes. And I think we'll continue to see that for the next several weeks.
Well, Paul, thank you for that. And of course, I hope you and the team and everyone around stay safe. Paul Adams, our correspondent in Dnipro in Ukraine.
Absolutely, Paul, doing great work for us in Ukraine. Steve Rosenberg's doing great work for us in Moscow as well. We'll be speaking to him about this subject around 7:30. But for now, at 19 minutes past six, a real treat for us, which is that Will Bain is once again not a disembodied voice in Salford, but a real person in the London studio. And he's got the business news.
You can be real people in Salford. I just want to point out.
Are real?
I was born in Salford.
I was going
so
to say, there's two people. There a lot, yeah.
Will is about as real as they come.
But also, I think his T-shirts are slightly less bright in person than on the big screen that I have of you guys when we're in the studio in Salford there as well. But lovely to see you in person nonetheless. Yeah, we're talking about car makers again this morning. We were chatting a little bit about this yesterday, weren't we? Because the car maker Nissan was one of those that was meeting the government late into the afternoon to discuss the zero emissions vehicle mandate. This came into force last year. You might remember rules on the percentage of electric vehicles manufacturers must sell or face fines. This year, for example, at least 22% of cars sold must be classed as zero emission. If manufacturers fail to hit that, they could face fines of up to £15,000 per car. Nissan last night called that target outdated and warned unless it was changed, the mandate would have a potentially irreversible impact on the UK automotive sector. Here's Nissan's Senior Vice President for Manufacturing and Supply Chain Management, Alan Johnson.
As the mandate's currently set up, we are faced with huge penalties and we have to pay these penalties by buying credits from other manufacturers who have earned those credits. The manufacturers who will earn the credits are manufacturers who only make EVs and they don't make those EVs in the UK.
David Bailey, Professor of Business Economics at the Birmingham Business School at Birmingham University, is with us. David's a specialist in the auto industry. Professor, morning.
Good morning.
First of all, just talk us through those credits that Alan Johnson's talking about. This is basically where companies that don't meet these targets can buy credits off ones that are meeting it, right?
That's right. So there's two ways in which firms don't need to hit the 22% target. One is by buying credits off other firms. The other way is by reducing the CO2 emissions from their petrol and diesel cars. And if they can do that as well, they also earn points. So they don't necessarily need to get to 22%. In Ford, for example, it's been estimated this year 17%. Toyota, it could be as low as 10%. So there may be more flexibility there than we are thinking. Having said that, it's still a big challenge in a market where demand for electric vehicles isn't growing very quickly.
What's your assessment of what Nissan are saying then, especially to your last point?
I think they have a point in the sense, I think the mandate was very badly introduced. The last government were consulting on it until very much the last minute, not giving car companies any time really to adapt to it. And also the companies that are just producing electric vehicles and then selling them into the UK, they're not getting any fines. So effectively we've set this system up with good intentions, but we are effectively going to fine the two biggest producers in the UK in the form of Nissan and Jaguar Land Rover. So we're kind of hampering our own industry.
Just spell that out. So, you know, if you're a pure electric company just selling into here, but you've got no manufacturing presence here, very unlikely to be fined. But actually, companies that potentially are supporting jobs, you know, industry in different parts of the country are the ones that are under pressure because they're the ones that have got to make the shift.
Absolutely right. And so what we're seeing really is the dilemma for government in terms of trying to encourage companies to go as quickly as possible towards electric vehicles on the one hand and shift us over to get to net zero. And at the same time, thinking about an industrial strategy and car companies, particularly in the Northeast and in the West Midlands, which support lots of jobs. And it's getting that balance right, which is the issue. I'm not sure the government have done enough to think about the domestic manufacturers.
How much of this, though, is a Nissan-specific issue? They were one of the first in the kind of electric vehicle space and yet seem to have been lapped by others.
Yes, that is an issue. I had one of their very first electric vehicles, the Nissan Leaf, some 10 years ago, and they've been overtaken in recent years, I think. So that is, there are company-specific issues about some firms which have not moved quick enough. And so those in favour of the mandate say, well, actually, we shouldn't be supporting them. at the same time, they are very big producers and very big employers in the UK.
And we heard from Ford yesterday as well, 800 jobs in the UK, 4,000 across the world. That was all, again, around this shift that a lot of those legacy companies, as they're called, are finding difficult to electric vehicles.
Yes, very much so. And the sort of double whammy there is, one, the onslaught of Chinese vehicles that are coming into the market at very low cost. The Chinese have been at this for 25 years. They can produce at 30%, 40% lower cost. European-based firms struggling to adapt to that. And secondly, the shift over to EVs more generally isn't happening as quickly as had been anticipated. So companies have made big investments into designing and building EVs, and the market isn't growing as quick enough.
David, thanks so much for your time this morning there.
Thank you.
David Bailey, Professor of Business Economics at the Birmingham Business School, and the government, to David's point there, saying they recognise the global challenges the industry has been facing. Ministers underlined the government's commitment at that meeting yesterday to working constructively and in close partnership with the sector as they support that transition to EVs by 2030, they tellingly say in this statement. And the UK automotive sector, they say, is now the fastest growth of zero emission vehicles of any major European market. Well, let's turn to the financial markets, and Lindsay James, investment strategist at Quilter Investors, is with us. Lindsay, morning.
Good morning.
And the big news overnight again is this company where markets all around the world, but particularly the S&P 500, sort of holds its breath when it announces financial results, and that's the chip maker Nvidia.
Yes, that's right. It's become a major data point now that investors follow. We had good numbers from them. Revenues at $35 billion for the quarter, about 6% ahead of expectations. Earnings also very strong, 78 cents. Now, that was about 4% higher than expected and up more than 100% from a year ago. So there's phenomenal growth still coming through this business.
So crazy growth, crazy revenue. Why on earth were the shares down at the close yesterday?
Well, it's really because their guidance for the fourth quarter was pretty much in line with what analysts were already expecting. So some good news that their new Blackwell chip is now in full production. They're seeing very strong demand for it, good sales. But analysts have really got there already with expectations already high for a business like this.
And what about challenges ahead? I guess the Trump administration potentially a bit something of a kind of double-edged sword for this. This industry and this company in particular, less regulation on AI presumably means more AI products, and they sell the chips that power the most powerful of those, but also likes to do a lot of business around the world, particularly in China, and changes to policy and restrictions on trade with that country could have a big impact on them.
Yeah, that's right. We've already seen some tit-for-tat responses from China with regard to limited limiting the scope for Nvidia in that huge market. Also, of course, TSMC in Taiwan, a big manufacturer of chips for Nvidia. Now, are the US really going to shoot themselves in the foot by putting tariffs on something they need to import when they effectively own that design process, but they don't manufacture all of them onshore? And actually, the CEO said previously it will take several decades before they would actually be able to do so. So I think we're going to see, more of this debate continuing about the effect that tariffs will actually have in reality.
And we chatted through those inflation figures from the Office for National Statistics on the show yesterday morning. Just what was your kind of takeaway, I suppose, and what is it telling the market about particularly what might happen with interest rates now? Are we going to see that cut that many thought we might see in December, do you think?
I'm not sure we will. The market's currently pricing in around 18% probability of a cut in December, and now only 2 to 3 rate cuts, quarter point rate cuts over the course of the next 12 months. So although the inflation data came out slightly higher than expected, 2.3% in the 12 months to October, the market was looking for about 2.2. The market had already got there, really, in terms of expecting inflation to tick up a little bit over the course of this part of the year. And so interest rate expectations had already sort of come down a little bit in terms of the number of rate cuts that were priced in.
Lindsay, thanks so much for your time this morning. Lindsay James there, investment strategist at Quilter Investors. Now, a company that's been struggling on the London Stock Exchange in recent months is Vistry, the house builder, in part because the chief operator officer is stepping down after the developer underestimated how much it would cost to build 9 of its sites in the south of England by £165 million. Earl Sibley will leave the company at the end of the year and his chief operating officer role will be scrapped. Vistry's had a difficult few months since it first disclosed this financial mishap. Its share price more than halved in just 6 weeks. Sarah Wilson is the CEO of the investor advisory group Minerva Analytics. Sarah, morning.
Good morning.
There's quite a backstory to go through. Why don't you run people through it?
Sure. So Vistry is a very interesting house building organisation. It works a lot with local authorities and housing associations. And what we've seen is a 165 million hole in the ground, two profit warnings, 20% votes against, share price halved. So I think shareholders are going to be rightly asking some questions as to whether a joint chairman and chief executive getting rid of his chief operating officer is actually going to be really improving good governance, or is actually just going to be tightening a very charismatic but somewhat Marmite individual's control over the board.
Yeah, Greg Fitzgerald, the chief exec and the chairman. We'll come to that in a moment, and the governance. But this matters, of course, Sarah, because this is one of our biggest house builders, and the government's got all these targets and ambitions it hopes to boost house building across the UK. Kind of needs them all in rude health, really.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, local authorities, housing associations, they are extremely cautious about governance issues. And this is going to really raise a red flag. And at a time like this, we really don't need this uncertainty. Investors want to feel confident that the houses are going to get built. And you know, we really have to look very closely at the board and the oversight that's going on inside this company. So few of the non-executive directors have any housing experience at all. And certainly we would be looking to see this board being strengthened. People with the recent and relevant experience in this area, you know, television and media, well, yeah, that's building stories, not building houses, buses, cinemas, publishing, casinos.
So a change in one of those two roles, perhaps the chairman above the CEO?
At the very least, you know, what you have now is only the CFO and the joint chair CFO who are actually from within the operations of the business. Everybody else is a non-executive director. And it's a model that we've seen develop a lot over the last 10 years, and it's really not healthy. The power dynamics are just not right. If the NEDs just don't have the insight into what's going on in the business, all the information is just being channeled through a few individuals.
Sarah, thanks so much for your time this morning. Sarah Wilson, the CEO of the investor advisory group Minerva Analytics, NEDs, non-executive directors. And we should say we did approach both Vistry and Greg Fitzgerald to see if they wanted to come on the programme. No one was available.
Well, Wayne, thank you. Here is Mike Williams with the sport at 6:30.
Emma, thank you. Good morning. Another win for Chelsea women last night. They have played 11, won 11 in all competitions this season. Their latest victory came in the Champions League, where they swept aside Celtic 3-0. England fullback Lucy Bronze on the score sheet at Stamford Bridge, as new manager Sonia Bonpastor watched Chelsea qualify for the quarterfinals with two games to spare.
I told the players before the game, tonight it was an opportunity for us to qualify for the quarterfinals, which we made. I think we remain top of the table, which is also something we wanted to make sure we achieved that goal. And I think, that's a great news.
Yes, Chelsea top of their group with 12 points from four matches. Also top of the WSL with seven wins from seven. Tonight in the Women's Champions League, Arsenal face Juventus and Manchester City go to the Swedish side Hammarby. Elsewhere in football, the Aston Villa owner Nassaf Sawias has said his club will join Manchester City in voting against amendments the Premier League has proposed to rules governing commercial deals. Top flight clubs will vote tomorrow on the changes to Associated Party Transaction Regulations, or APTs. Sawiris, who is Egypt's richest man, says the vote on APTs should be delayed until February to increase the chances of unanimous support. Next, tennis, and Italy are the Billie Jean King Cup winners. They beat Slovakia 2-0 yesterday in the final, winning both singles rubbers in straight sets, Jasmine Paolini clinching the deciding singles match in Malaga. It is Italy's fifth Billie Jean King Cup, or Fed Cup, title, and also caps a remarkable year for Italian tennis that's seen world number one Jannik Sinner win his first two Grand Slam titles, and Paolini herself also make the Wimbledon final.
I think it's an unbelievable year for Italian tennis, and it's so good for our sport in our country. And to finish like that it's a dream. I'm glad that we were able to do it. It's not easy, you know, after the last year that we lost in the final, and we deserve it, I think.
That's Jasmine Paolini. Meanwhile, Germany will face the Netherlands in the semi-finals of the Davis Cup after a 2-0 win over Canada in the last eight in Malaga. Later today, Italy will take on Argentina and the USA face Australia for a place in the last four. And finally, Stephen Maguire is the latest name to qualify for Snooker's UK Championship in York. Also through to today's first round are Jackson Page, Jack Jones, Stuart Bingham and Jack Lazowski, who ended 21-year-old Bayou Lou's hopes of becoming the first woman to reach the main draw.
Mike, thank you very much indeed. And here is news of this year's Wreath Lectures.
I'm Anita Arnand, hosting the Wreath Lectures 2024.
The series is about the complexity of human violence. All violence is not the same, and all violence perpetrators are not the same.
Four questions about violence, explored by the forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Gwen Adshead.
By listening to perpetrators, we can learn more about the genesis of violence, and perhaps particularly where we might be able to intervene to reduce the risk of violence happening in the future.
The Wreath Lectures 2024, starting on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, next Tuesday morning at 9.
Sounds absolutely fascinating. Thank you for that introduction, Anita. Always a highlight and something to learn from, especially that particular topic in light of, always the news. 26 minutes to 7, you are listening to Today. Good to be with you. Good to have your company on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amal Rajan. And now we have a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
The former Deputy Prime Minister, Lord Prescott, who was a major figure in the Labour Party for decades, has died at the age of 86. In a statement, his family said he'd been living with Alzheimer's. John Prescott served in Tony Blair's government, where he was a crucial bridge between Labour's traditional roots and the modernising wing of the party. He'd begun his career as a ship steward before becoming an MP in Hull and later Secretary of State for Environment and Transport when he helped agree the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. The Defence Secretary John Healey will face questions from MPs today after it was revealed that Ukraine fired British-supplied missiles into Russia for the first time. The government hasn't confirmed nor denied the use of the Storm Shadow weapons. The United States has approved more than £200 million of further military aid for Ukraine. A BBC investigation has found that thousands of pounds worth of British mini-computers have been shipped to companies in Russia sanctioned for their links to the military. The Raspberry Pi circuit boards were designed to help children learn to code, but have been discovered in Russian drones used against Ukraine. The company denies involvement. A highly critical report by the Charity Commission has said the family of Captain Sir Tom Moore received almost £1.5 million from a book deal, but repeatedly refused to give any of it to the foundation set up in his name. The war veteran raised money for the NHS during lockdown by walking laps of his garden. The family said the report had treated them unfairly and that the process was unjust and excessive. The rate at which children have been suspended from state primary schools in England has more than doubled in the past decade. BBC analysis of data also found exclusions had risen by 70%, with the most common reason being persistent disruptive behaviour. The US government has proposed making Google sell its Chrome browser to break up its dominance in online searches. The Department of Justice also wants the firm to stop paying device makers to establish Google as the preferred search browser.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. And just to confirm, if you're waking up to this news, John Prescott, Lord Prescott, has died. He was born in Prestatyn in Wales in 1938. Before the outbreak of the war, his family moved to Rotherham in Chester. He notoriously failed his 11+. It haunted him and drove him forever. And the tributes are now coming in from around the world, including this just in from former Vice President Al Gore, who worked with John Prescott on the Kyoto Protocol in 1997. He said, Al Gore, this is, "I've never worked with anyone in politics on my side of the pond or his quite like John Prescott. He possessed an inherent ability to connect with people about the issues that mattered to them, a talent that others spend years studying and cultivating, but that was second nature to him. He fought like hell to negotiate the Kyoto Protocol and was an unwavering champion of climate action for decades." John Prescott came into Parliament in 1970 as MP for Kingston-upon-Hull East and remained in that role until he joined the Lords in 2010, giving him a political career spanning over five decades.
I come from the trade union movement. I'm a typical creature of the movement. I came out of 10 years of seafaring that taught me all the industrial strength and the industrial muscle, couldn't achieve all that I wanted, that I needed a political party to make the changes to achieve the objective that I want.
John Prescott, who's died at the age of 86. Let's talk to Henry Zeffirin, our chief political correspondent. Henry, there's an extraordinary character just in terms of the politics. He himself said that his great contribution was as a kind of marriage counsellor between the twin pillars of New Labour.
Certainly towards the end of the New Labour years, as the Brown-Blair relationship deteriorated, you know, both of those personalities acknowledged that John Prescott was a huge force in just getting them in the same room and ironing out their differences, both personality and policy. But I think what is clear from all the autobiographies and memoirs and diaries that have now been published about the New Labour years, and also about the tributes which are flooding in already this morning, is that he was something more than that. I mean, just administratively, John Prescott was not merely Deputy Prime Minister. For the first several years of the Blair government, he was Secretary of State for Environment, Transport and the Regions. Those are now jobs and departments done by three different cabinet ministers, all of which he was overseeing. He chaired lots of cabinet committees, but also Tony Blair talks of relying on him as a kind of sounding board. And we've actually just had a tribute through from Tony Blair where he says it is no exaggeration to say the Labour Party could never have won three consecutive full terms without John. I relied on him many times when in difficulty, under attack, and when I needed someone whose gut instinct I trusted better than my own.
Well, if all goes to plan, we're hoping to speak to Tony Blair live on this programme in just over 30 minutes' time. It's worth saying, Henry, that what was extraordinary about where he ended up as Lord Prescott in the Lords, you know, playing croquet at Dorneywood notoriously, was just astonishing given where he began. Born in Prestatyn, son of a railway signalman, someone who notoriously failed his 11 plus and was haunted by that forever.
And that's the thing. He was a bridge between Blair and Brown, and politically he was probably a bridge between New Labour and a more traditional left wing or sort of traditionalist union background part of the Labour Party. And he used that to huge effect, both for Tony Blair when he was trying to win over the unions to his changes to Clause 4, the statement of the Labour Party's principles, but actually also less remembered a couple of years before when John Smith, Tony Blair's predecessor, wanted to reform the union bloc vote. He relied on a barnstorming speech from John Prescott to sell it to the trade unions. But he was also probably in the 90s, as Britain was changing and becoming more middle class, he was an incarnation of that in the Labour Party, helping the Labour Party retain its traditional supporters, even as it was broadening its appeal to new groups in society who perhaps hadn't supported it before.
Henry, thank you. And just to say, yes, Tony Blair will be on with us in just under half an hour's time, and we're hoping to speak also to Gordon Brown at 8:10.
Indeed, at 19 minutes to seven, let's look across the world, though, to what is being billed as a world first. Australia will be introducing and is introducing legislation that will ban under 16s from using social media. It does need to be debated, this bill, but I was been speaking to our Australia correspondent, Katie Watson, a little earlier, and I was asking what this change could mean.
Once the legislation is passed, it's got to pass both houses, it will mean that anybody under the age of 16 won't be able to access social media apps like TikTok, Instagram, and there will be no exception. So even if parents give their children consent, it will still be against the law. However, once this legislation is passed, the companies, the social media companies, have a year or perhaps more to work on how to make sure that the people under 16 are kept safe. They'll be working with the e-safety commissioner, the internet regulator here in Australia, to work out how to enforce the rules. So any rules are not going to come into effect for at least 12 months. And it will also not apply to messaging apps. It won't apply to online gaming or to any platforms that use apps for education or health purposes. But I mean, this is a framework, and that's the thing. There's still a lot of detail to be worked out, namely how to make sure that those who are not allowed to access social media apps do not access those apps, because that's one of the big criticisms. It'll be probably very easy, as critics say, to find ways around this legislation.
What's the background to why Australia is doing this? And you know, it's being talked of as a world first bill.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says he's doing this for the mums and dads. That was something he said a few weeks ago. It's been reiterated today that it's about protecting children, not isolating them, as well as supporting parents who worry about the mental health of those under 16 and accessing these apps. And I think, I mean, this isn't an Australian issue, of course. It's a global issue. And I think a lot of countries who've tried this or want to try this are going to be looking to Australia to see how it works. But Australia, you know, talks about this being a world first. And certainly it's got the support of the opposition party and it's expected to go through. But, I mean, it's not without criticism. Most experts that I've had conversations with have huge doubts about how enforceable this is, but also how it will keep children safe, because the key issue is also education. And that's something that government has said that it will work with as well.
We'll get into some more of that detail throughout the programme. Katie, thank you. Yes, we will. We'll be speaking to the man tasked with age verification checks and looking at that for Australia and for us here in the UK, and seeing how it's not been done anywhere, if it actually can work and how it may work. A bit later on in the programme, especially if you're concerned by that, we hope to get some answers.
It's 16 minutes to seven.
And to turn our attention now to what's been described as a damning report. This is because the late Sir Captain Tom Moore, who raised nearly £40 million for the NHS during the pandemic, doing laps of his garden, a long-awaited report into the charity that bears his name has found that his daughter and her husband mismanaged that foundation and that there were repeat instances of misconduct. The Charity Commission said that they damaged public trust in charities by refusing to donate any of the £1.4 million received from the late 100-year-old Army veterans' book deal. With more detail on this, I'm joined by our investigations correspondent, Joe Pike. Joe, it's a long-awaited report. It is a damning report. It's detailed as well. What do you think are the most significant revelations in there?
Emma, I've been investigating concerns about this charity for more than a year. What is new and notable and startling, really, I think, is details of this enormous publishing deal. An advance of £1.47 million for Captain Sir Tom's three books, including his best-selling autobiography. That money was paid to Club Nook, a company run by Hannah and Colin, the daughter and son-in-law of the fundraiser. The important context here is the publisher and the promoter said the family gave repeated assurances that part of that advance would be used to set up and fund the foundation, the charity, and the press release, various marketing materials, and even the prologue of Captain Sir Tom's memoir all said the books would be used to support or raise money for the foundation. The charity, though, still has received absolutely nothing from that. The regulator has asked Hannah and Colin Ingram-Moore twice to rectify matters by making a donation to the charity. On both occasions, they've declined. And the commission has told me the publications were a purely commercial endeavour and had, as you've pointed out, Emma, so they damaged public trust in charities.
Because people expected the money from that book to go towards charity. That's the point.
Exactly, yeah.
And the family have responded how, and we should say we did invite Hannah onto the programme, the daughter onto the programme.
They have released a statement, Emma, saying the report has treated them unfairly, the process was unjust and excessive, the Charity Commission had a predetermined agenda. On the point of this large book deal, the family have accused the Charity Commission of a breach of privacy because part of the deal was publicly disclosed, and the Charity Commission actually had to use legal powers, I think, to get hold of that. They've also said the publisher paid Captain Sir Tom a fee, it was his, and he decided what to do with it. We should also say, as you pointed out, that £39 million given to NHS charities as part of Captain Tom's fundraising has never been in question. But certainly, Emma, today, I think the actions of his family seem to have damaged his legacy.
Joe Pike, the investigations, our investigations correspondent, who's been looking into this, thank you, and we'll be speaking to the head of the Charity Commission a bit later in the programme.
13 minutes to seven, worth saying that most of the papers obviously don't have the news, I mean their websites now do, but the papers in their print editions don't have the news of Lord Prescott's death. So most of them have led with Ukraine. I'll just take you through some of the headlines. This is the fact that UK missiles are being used by Ukraine to hit Russia. So the Daily Telegraph, defence cuts as UK missiles hit Russia. Storm shadows strike military facility in Kursk as £500 million is axed from the armed forces. Daily Mail, up to 12 British storm shadows fired into Russia. Starmer personally approved the missile strike. First UK weapons on Russian territory since the 1919 Bolshevik clashes. Daily Express has got same story. So to the FT, Ukraine fires UK-made missiles into Russia as Kyiv's allies doubled down. And the I paper, UK defies Putin as Ukraine fires British missiles into Russia.
On the front page of The Guardian, there's a story about the assisted dying bill feeling rushed. This is a coalition between Labour MP Diane Abbott and the Conservative MP Sir Edward Lee, both the longest serving MPs, the respective mother and father, as it's described, of the House of Commons. They've issued a joint call urging the Commons to reject the bill, saying it's been rushed through and it puts vulnerable people at risk, saying also that there has been this insufficient scrutiny, and has urged Parliament to instead focus on better health and care services. It's, of course, a very controversial bill, many views being shared on it, not least in the Times today, the columnist Catelyn Moran talking about, "I love life," says the headline of her column, "but I think I should be able to decide when I die." And it's so it goes on. But in the Daily Mail, just a different story to bring your attention to. A survey has shown that 1 in 12 of us, or 8%, still use physical cash all of the time. And interestingly, this survey found that around a third of cash users on low income said that better protection against fraud would make them more likely to switch to other payment methods.
Interesting stuff. 11 minutes to 7. That news about Ukraine hadn't filtered through to the Commons yesterday as MPs gathered for Prime Minister's questions. But as our parliamentary correspondent Alicia McCarthy now reports, there was still plenty on the agenda in a session with a difference.
It's nearly 6,000 miles from Rio de Janeiro to London, and Keir Starmer wasn't going to get back from the G20 gathering of world leaders in time for his weekly round of Prime Minister's questions. If the PM can't make it, his deputy steps in, which meant once again it was Angela Rayner taking the lead for Labour. By convention, if the Prime Minister isn't there, the other major parties field a sub too. So, who would the new Tory leader Kemi Badenoch pick for the job?
We now come to Alex Burkhardt, the Shadow Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. Yay!
The Speaker announcing Alex Burkhardt, an ally of Kemi Badenoch and part of the team who've helped prep her for the two sessions of PMQs she's done since being elected leader of the Tory party. He started with a question as crisp as his pressed white shirt and royal blue tie.
What is the government doing to bring down inflation?
The inflation figures, released just hours earlier, had shown a rise to 2.3%, with the sharpest month-on-month increase for 2 years. Now, Alex Burkhardt might not be a household name, but he's been in Parliament since 2017, and Angela Rayner remembered that he'd had a job in a previous Conservative government.
Many people might not know, Mr Speaker, but the Honourable Member was the Minister for Growth when, under Liz Truss, inflation...
But the inflation figures weren't the only thing on Alex Burkhardt's mind. On Tuesday, thousands of farmers marched on Westminster in protest at a change to inheritance tax, which means farms valued at over £1 million will now have to pay it, albeit at a reduced rate of 20%. Alex Burkhardt had been talking to some of them.
Some of them families who farmed their land for centuries, elderly men in tears, children worried about their parents, all of them worried that their way of life is about to be destroyed. What would the Right Honourable Lady like to say to them?
Yeah. To a barrage of shouting from both sides, Angela Rayner said Labour was absolutely committed to British farmers and the vast majority would see no change and pay no tax.
Couples can pass on £3 million, Mr Speaker, tax-free, and those above the thresholds will pay only half the normal rate and can pay over 10 years interest-free.
But Alex Burkhardt reckoned that left a lot unsaid.
All the farmers at home will have heard there was no guarantee there. We know what that means. They're coming back for more.
Yeah. Angela Rayner reckoned that was pretty cheeky.
It was his government that raised taxes to the highest level for a generation.
Back on his feet, Alex Burkhardt leaned forward, folded his arms on the dispatch box and put his questions so loudly the microphone struggled to cope. He accused the government of having policies that punish people who didn't vote Labour, like parents who sent their kids to private schools.
It's the same punishment meted out to the owners of small businesses terrified about national insurance contributions, and it's the same punishment meted out to pensioners who can't afford to pay their fuel this winter. Isn't it the truth, Mr Speaker, that if you don't vote Labour, they don't care about you?
But the Deputy Prime Minister accused the Tories of not learning the lessons of the election.
We We took the difficult decisions to fix the £22 billion black hole that they left behind. And while they're reinventing the past, we're investing in the future.
The Deputy Lib Dem leader, Daisy Cooper, had also been talking to the farmers who'd taken to the streets.
Farmers told me yesterday that they feel as though they had been betrayed by the Conservatives, but they now feel like they have also been lied to by Labour. Will the Deputy Prime Minister think again on this measure so that our farmers can feed Britain?
While Reform UK's Lee Anderson put it rather more bluntly.
Just a few weeks ago, from that dispatch box, the Minister for Rural Affairs said that he'd been congratulated by a farmer over the introduction of the inheritance tax. Now, I think this farmer must have been a cannabis farmer, because just yesterday we had 10,000 farmers on Whitehall protesting against this madcap decision.
Angela Rayner chose not to get embroiled in that one, saying simply that the government would continue to support farmers.
And you can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on BBC Sounds. It's now 7 minutes to 7.
It's being billed as a show of international support for Ukraine. The Storm Shadow missiles supplied by the UK now fired at targets within Russia for the first time. We're expecting the Defence Secretary John Healey to face questions in Parliament from MPs today about the use of these long-range missiles, which the government hasn't confirmed or denied, and what it means for Ukraine's continued war effort. Joining me now, Matthew Saville, Director of Military Sciences at RUSI and a former Ministry of Defence civil servant. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we just start with explaining what these missiles are, why they're important, how they work?
Well, these are essentially air-launched cruise missiles. So you launch them from your jet. We've been using them for years, originally from our Tornado aircraft and more recently from Typhoons. In this case, we have given them to the Ukrainians and they've been modified so they can launch them from old, actually Soviet aircraft. And they effectively are very good at getting into defended, well-protected targets. So they're not supersonic, but they fly low, hug the terrain, and then they sort of pop up and identify their target and strike it with a dual warhead. So they break through, you know, thick barriers like concrete or reinforced protection. And then a second warhead detonates inside and you have destroyed your bunker or headquarters normally.
What sort of difference could they make to Ukraine's war effort? Zelensky, President Zelensky, has been lobbying for the ability to use them for some time.
Well, these have been used very effectively by the Ukrainians within Ukraine, including in Crimea against lots of targets like the Black Sea Fleet headquarters. Actually, they were used against a submarine that was in dry dock, which was an unusual use. They've got a reasonable range. Their use in this case, though, their impact rather might be more limited, and that's partly because of a couple of factors. First, we don't know how many they have. The UK gave a fairly significant proportion of its stockpile and they've been using them for 18 months, so they might not have many left. Second, they're being used outside the area of kind of greatest crisis for the Ukrainians, which is on the east. So these will be useful alongside the American ballistic missiles, ATACMS, to try and protect the Kursk incursion that the Ukrainians have got on Russian territory. But the problem they're facing at the moment is around the Donbass, where Russian forces are, if you like, still grinding forwards and pushing the Ukrainians back.
In terms of a response from the Kremlin or an update on how Russia is doing on the battlefield, what can we say on that? What do we know? I'm just thinking of the fact we were listening to our correspondent in Dnipro in the last hour talking about having been up since 3 o'clock in the morning there because there have been explosions overnight.
Yeah, so we talk about escalation an awful lot during this conflict, and it's right to take that seriously, including you know, the more significant issues of a NATO-Russia clash. But the Russians have been escalating throughout in terms of targeting civilian infrastructure, civilian targets, bombing cities. And this, if you like, conventional use of weapons, whilst it is more controversial in Russian eyes because it's very obviously a NATO-supplied weapon, yes, detonating on their territory. In fact, they have seemed to have priced a lot of this support in. So they make a big noise, but ultimately what they do is continue to fight the fight. I think The UK and other international partners will be on the lookout, though, for sabotage, subversion and Russian disruption elsewhere against their interests, because we do have, you know, the Director General of the Security Service talked about this recently, this increasing Russian threat and activity aimed at trying to not conduct military attacks on NATO countries, but these smaller scale covert actions.
Matthew Saville, Director of Military Services at RUSI and a former Ministry of Defence civil servant. Thank you.
On BBC iPlayer.
You have few friends, Cromwell. Because of what you are, they don't know how to deal with you.
The conclusion of the BAFTA and Golden Globe winning series Wolf Hall.
The king never does an unpleasant thing. Lord Cromwell does it for him.
Starring Damian Lewis.
My patience is not infinite, neither with you nor my daughter.
And Mark Rylance.
When negotiation and compromise fail, and your only course is to destroy your enemy before they wake in the morning, have the axe in your hand.
The new series of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, The Mirror and the Light. Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Can't wait. I need to still watch the first, though. Let's get the latest on the weather from Simon King.
Emma, thanks so much. Yeah, a wintry mix this morning, a frost quite widely across the UK, but we've got some rain, sleet and hill snow moving its way in at the moment across southwest England. Quite a lot of snow expected over the moors and tors of the southwest this morning. Even down to some low levels, there could be a few centimetres of snow falling. That's all moving its way eastwards, so parts of maybe West Sussex, the Downs, may get this wintry mix of rain, sleet and snow as well. Elsewhere across England and Wales, dry with some sunshine today, but some wintry showers coming in across the far north and the west of Wales. Maximum temperatures getting to about 1 to 4 or 5 degrees. Across Scotland and Northern Ireland, frequent snow showers still moving into northern, northwestern areas of Scotland. Significant accumulations, even down to some relatively low levels. 1 or 2 wintry showers in Northern Ireland as well. Some sunny spells, temperatures of 1 to 4 Celsius.
Thanks very much, Simon. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 21st of November. Good morning, if you're just joining us. The headlines. The former Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott, Lord Prescott, a towering figure in the Labour Party for several decades, has died at the age of 86. He was one of the party's great campaigners.
I'll not be leaving the political fight. I'll never leave the political fight. I'll never give up campaigning for the Labour Party. Yes, I'll be swapping me government jag for this bus pass to campaign for Labour.
And after the news, we'll be hearing from Sir Tony Blair and his reflections and memories of Lord John Prescott. Also on the programme, a report by the Charity Commission says the family of Captain Sir Tom Moore received more than £1 million from a book deal, but didn't give any of it to its foundation. The family says the report is unfair. The Chief Executive of the Charity Commission will join us before 8 o'clock to talk through its findings. And MPs in Australia have begun considering new measures to ban under-16s from social media. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
The former Deputy Prime Minister Lord Prescott, who was a major figure in the Labour Party for decades, has died at the age of 86. He'd had a stroke in 2019 and his family said he'd been living with Alzheimer's. John Prescott provided an important link between Labour's traditional left wing in the trade union movement and the modernising faction of the party. Our political correspondent Ben Wright looks back at his life.
As the Labour Party modernised under John Smith and Tony Blair, John Prescott was a proud working-class bridge to its past. A former ship steward, he had deep roots in the trade union movement.
I came out of 10 years of seafaring that taught me all the industrial strength and the industrial muscle, couldn't achieve all that I wanted, that I needed a political party to make the changes to achieve the...
In office, Blair valued his deputy's loyalty, and John Prescott played a key role mediating the fractious relationship between the Prime Minister and his Chancellor Gordon Brown.
He has got very, very great strength.
John is John. That was Tony Blair's affectionately rueful reaction when his deputy punched an egg-throwing protester during the 2001 general election. It cemented John Prescott's reputation as a no-nonsense political bruiser. Following Labour's landslide in 1997, Prescott ran a huge department that spanned transport, planning and the environment. He played a key role setting up the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. Famously fond of his Jaguar cars, the man dubbed Two Jags in office revealed he had ditched them when he appeared at the COP climate summit in 2021. John Prescott's contortions with the English language were often mocked by a press he seemed to loathe, but he brought colour and conviction to the new Labour Party.
The former US Vice President Al Gore, who worked with John Prescott on the Kyoto Climate Change Agreement, said he possessed an inherent ability to connect with people about the issues that mattered to them. Tony Blair said he was devastated by the passing of his former deputy. He called John Prescott one of the most talented people he'd ever encountered in politics. Our political editor, Chris Mason, considers his singular presence.
The completely unique Prescott blend of charm and brutality, made always more effective by the unpredictability of which would be predominant, got you through the decade. So wrote Tony Blair in a private letter to John Prescott in the days after leaving Downing Street as Prime Minister in 2007. Sir Tony later wrote in his memoirs, "He could be maddening, he could be dangerous, he could be absurd, he could be magnificent. Never dull, placid, uneventful, forgettable." Amid the slick middle-class polish of New Labour, John Prescott personified a blunt grit, proudly working class, proud of his trades union background, proud to bind his party's past with its present. From a seafaring waiter as a young man, he was, via the European Parliament and much later the House of Lords, to become the country's longest-serving Deputy Prime Minister.
A highly critical report by the Charity Commission has said the family of Captain Sir Tom Moore received almost £1.5 million from a book deal, but repeatedly refused to give any of it to the foundation set up in his name. Captain Sir Tom raised money for the NHS during lockdown by walking laps of his garden. The war veteran's daughter and son-in-law have been banned from being charity trustees for 10 and 8 years, respectively. Here's our investigations correspondent, Joe Pike.
Captain Sir Tom Moore raised £39 million, which all went to NHS charities. But it's the actions of his daughter Hannah and her husband Colin which the Charity Commission has said amounts to misconduct, mismanagement or both. It said they repeatedly personally benefited from the charity that was set up in his name, including the money from a deal for 3 books. The publisher and promoter of those books said the family gave repeated assurances that part of the advance would be used to set up and fund the Captain Tom Foundation. The charity has yet to receive any of it. The Ingramores have said this report has treated them unfairly, the process was unjust and excessive, and the Charity Commission had a predetermined agenda. The Captain Tom Foundation, which is now likely to be closed down, said it implored the Ingramores to return the funds due to the foundation so they could be donated to well-deserving charities.
There's been a surge in the rate at which children are being suspended or excluded permanently from state primary schools in England. The BBC analysed data from the last 10 years and found that suspensions had more than doubled, while exclusions had risen by 70%. Last year there were 84,000 suspensions compared with 38,000 a decade ago. Here's our education correspondent Elaine Dunkley.
The most common reason for a primary school pupil being suspended or excluded was persistent disruptive behaviour. More than 90% of those permanently excluded in the past 5 years also had special educational needs and disabilities. Teaching unions are warning that a shortage of funding, a lack of support for pupils with special educational needs, and long waiting lists for speech and language therapists are leading to an increase in disruptive behaviour among primary school children. The Department for Education says the surge in suspensions and permanent exclusions was left to spiral out of control, and it will invest £1 billion into special educational needs and will go further to support pupils and teachers.
Hospital officials in northern Gaza say many people have been killed in the latest Israeli airstrikes. At least 5 buildings in Beit Lahia and Gaza City are reported to have been hit early this morning. There's been no comment from the Israeli military. Our Middle East correspondent Yulan Nell reports from Jerusalem.
Gazan rescue teams say search operations began early this morning after Israel bombed at least 5 buildings in Beit Lahia and Gaza City. Hamas-aligned media say dozens of people have been killed and that many are still buried in the rubble, including women and children. The Israeli military has recently intensified its offensive in northern Gaza, saying it's stopping Hamas from regrouping. Medics say they're struggling to treat the injured, with aid agencies saying they can't get essential supplies into the area. Meanwhile, the US mediator Amos Hochstein has arrived in Israel from Beirut. He said that he sees a real opportunity to end the conflict in Lebanon after the Lebanese government and Hezbollah largely agreed to a US ceasefire proposal.
Australia has introduced legislation that will ban under-16s from accessing social media. Speaking to Parliament, the Communications Minister, Michelle Rowland, said it was a world-first bill that would protect young Australians at a critical stage in their development. Our Sydney correspondent Katie Watson reports.
The government says this new bill is about protecting young people, not punishing or isolating them. Under the new proposals, nobody under the age of 16 will have access to social media apps like Instagram and TikTok, but initially messaging apps and online gaming, as well as platforms used for education and health purposes, will be excluded from the ban. The onus won't be on parents or users to comply, it'll be on the social media companies, who now have at least a year to come up with ways of preventing young people from accessing the platforms. If they fail to do so, they face fines as high as £26 million. The bill will need to pass both houses before it becomes law and is expected to go to the Senate next week.
The US government has proposed making Google sell its Chrome browser to break up its dominance in online searches. The call follows a court ruling in August that Google was illegally crushing its competition. The Department of Justice also wants the firm to stop paying device makers to establish Google as the preferred search browser. The list of proposed remedies will be presented to a judge who will make a decision next year.
Thanks very much, Jane. It's 7:09. John Prescott, the waiter on cruise liners who became Britain's longest-serving deputy prime minister, has died. His family said this morning he had spent his life trying to improve the lives of others, fighting for social justice and protecting the environment. He died, they said, surrounded by the love of his family and the jazz music of Marion Montgomery. John, later Lord Prescott, was MP for Hull East for almost 40 years, and in the 1990s he was the union man who helped win support as Labour began to change, first when John Smith was leader, with this crucial conference speech in 1993.
There's no doubt this man, our leader, put his head on the block by saying, basically, I fervently believe, because that's what he believes, of a relationship and a strong one with the trade unions and the Labour Party. He's put his head there. Now's our time to vote. Give us a bit of trust and let's have this vote support.
John Prescott continued that crucial bridge-building role between the Labour hierarchy and the party's working-class supporters when he became deputy leader and then deputy prime minister for 10 years under Tony Blair. Sir Tony Blair, former prime minister, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling devastated, actually, we knew it was coming because he'd been very ill. But my deepest condolences to Pauline, to David and Jonathan, the family who were a huge support to him. And yeah, there was no one quite like him in British politics.
Yes, you've said that without him, the Labour Party couldn't have won three consecutive full terms. What do you think it was?
Well, people often used to see him as traditional Labour as opposed to New Labour, and that was true to a degree. I mean, he obviously came from a completely different background from me. He reached parts of the Labour Party, parts of the electorate that probably I couldn't reach. But he was actually an innovator. He was highly, highly intelligent. That was sometimes masked by, you know, people used to make fun of his speeches and his use of the English language. But he was an incredibly direct communicator. And even if the syntax never quite made sense, the sentiment was very powerful and made complete sense. And I found him, you know, we had our disagreements from time to time, but he was loyal, committed, and enormous help to me. And he had a fantastic gut instinct about politics.
You know, even though you say you knew it was coming, it must be an emotional thing to hear this and also to know someone that you were so close to isn't here anymore.
Yeah, and, you know, I came to have a huge, genuine affection for him. I mean, this has surprised people because they always thought of us as just the kind of yin and the yang, and I'm never quite sure who was the yin and who was the yang, and maybe it switched around at points. But I also had a lot of a lot of really funny times with him. I mean, he could be a very amusing guy. And I was just thinking this morning about the time when in the 2001 election, remember when someone smashed an egg on his head and he turned around and he punched the guy and laid him out. And this caused a huge sort of fracas, obviously, and was immense media story. And we had to give our press conference in the election campaign the next day. And some people were saying, well, look, he's deputy prime minister. You know, you can't have a deputy prime minister thumping a voter. And then there were other people said, yeah, but, you know, he had this egg slammed in his head and he turned around and whacked the guy. And a lot of people will think, well, fair enough. And so there was nothing you could do. So we had a long debate about it. And finally at the press conference, when I was asked about it, I just said, well, John is John. And everyone said, was that supposed to be an answer? And I said, yeah, that's an answer. That's as much as you can say. And that's what he was like. There were no rules that he really abided by. But I feel a huge sense of loss because it wasn't just a political relationship. I had a profound affection for him.
What was the best bit of advice he gave you, do you think?
Oh, the best advice was always to remember that we had two bits of the coalition. One bit of the coalition was, you know, your progressive and middle class, but the other was your aspirational working class. And it's very important to realize this about John. He was proud of his working class roots, but he didn't celebrate them in the sense of saying, you know, I want everyone to stay as they are. He was fully aligned with that really vital element for the Labour Party always to connect with, which is the aspirations of people who are working class to become better off, to become more prosperous, more fulfilled, you know, use their potential better.
Yes, and I suppose when looking at politically what he was trying to do, it's come up very, very quickly, his contribution on the climate, which maybe people don't necessarily remember, but that contribution to Kyoto.
Yeah, it was a very big contribution, by the way, because people forget this. I mean, now, well, most people say that climate change is real, that it's happening. We got to do something about it. Back then, when we were negotiating the first climate change treaty, it was heavily disputed. John was absolutely integral to getting that Kyoto Treaty passed. He did a lot of the negotiating himself. He was a very good negotiator, by the way. I mean, unconventional, but very effective. And that was a big contribution. And, you know, he maintained an interest in that right up until the end. Even in these last months, I discussed that issue with him.
Did you talk to him a lot in the last few months?
Yeah, we would have a session on the, you know, video together. And, you know, even though he was failing and very ill, he was still as lively and punchy as ever.
I feel like he's one of the few people to you, Tony Blair, might be able to say certain things and, you know, put things in perspective.
Yeah, he would. I mean, sometimes he used to come in and, you know, he had this extraordinary instinctive sense that something was afoot. And he often used to come in unannounced into my room in Downing Street. And he would say to me, I know you're up to something. I don't know quite what it is, but I know you're up to something. And I would be sort of protesting and saying, no, John, you got it all wrong. And he said, no, I haven't. And of course, he'd always be right. I would be up to something. But, you know, once we had a difficult issue, we'd talk about it. He was often, you know, presenting a different point of view. But once we came to a decision, he got behind it. And, you know, he was a vital part of keeping the whole show together.
Well,
remember, he governed for twice as long as the last Labour government's ever governed. So that was down in a large part to him and to his commitment.
I was going to say, he's been described as a marriage counsellor between you and Gordon Brown. I don't know if you recognise that.
Well, yeah, there was a bit of that too, yeah, I think. But he got on with both of us because he believed it was in the interest of the Labour Party that whatever differences we had in the jostling, which is inevitable in politics that you have, you know, he recognizes, I recognize Gordon's enormous ability, and he was always keen for us to work together as well as you could in the circumstances. But he looked upon himself as a bridge, and indeed was a bridge.
We'll be hearing from Gordon Brown a bit later in the programme. I just was looking back at something you'd written in your book, A Journey, your autobiography, and you recalled how Prince Charles, now King, was taken aback after his first meeting with John Prescott, and apparently asked if he did that thing with you, talking about the fact that he balanced his teacup and saucer on his tummy. Do you remember that? That's quite a vision.
Yes, I remember. I remember now His Majesty saying that to me and saying, what do you think it signifies? And I said, I don't think it really signifies anything, but it was classic John. But he would have had the same blunt conversation with the then Prince Charles as he would have had with me.
Yeah, perhaps with a cup of saucer on his stomach. It's just something to no, think
it's,
of.
It's an image. It's what he used to do with me as well. He'd sit there, but he was, you know, I don't think, to be honest, I'd ever met anyone quite like John, and I still don't think I've ever met anyone quite like him. And I'm very sad that he's passed, but I am happy to celebrate his life and his achievements.
Yes, and it must also just be a moment. And is it in all of our lives, as we get to that point when we start to lose friends and we think about what matters and mortality and have those moments. So Tony Blair, it's very nice to be able to hear some of your recollections this morning working with him, but also on a personal level.
Thank you very much.
Sir Tony Blair, remembering the late, now John Prescott, Lord Prescott.
It's worth saying that in the last few moments, a statement's been released by Sir Keir Starmer. The Prime Minister says the following: I'm deeply saddened to hear the death of John Prescott. John was a true giant of the Labour movement. He was a staunch defender of working people and a proud trade unionist. During a decade as Deputy Prime Minister, he was one of the key architects of a Labour government that transformed the lives of millions of people across the nation. So much of John's work set the path for those of us fortunate enough to follow, from leading climate negotiations to fighting regional inequality. His legacy will live on well beyond his lifetime. And the statement finishes by saying, on behalf of the Labour Party, I send my condolences to Pauline and all his family, to the city of Hull, which he served as MP for 40 years, and to all those who knew him and loved him. May he rest in peace. Time now is 20 minutes past 7. Australia's Parliament has started debating what it calls world-first legislation to restrict children under the age of 16 from accessing social media apps like Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat and TikTok. The new legislation needs to pass both houses before it becomes law, and the social media companies will have at least a year to come up with the solutions that they think will prevent children from getting on their platforms. Otherwise, they'll face fines of as much as $33 million. That's £26 million. Our correspondent Katie Watson now reports from Sydney.
This is about protecting young people, not punishing or isolating them.
Australia's Communications Minister Michelle Rowland made the government's position very clear. For too many children, she said, social media is harmful.
This bill seeks to set a new normative value in society that accessing social media is not the defining feature of growing up in Australia. Yeah. I commend the bill to the House.
Yeah. Politicians are now debating the legislation in Canberra, but it's a discussion being had well beyond the corridors of power.
It would be helpful for not using your phone all the time, but it's not really good for communities. Some people need to have communities online.
Honestly, I think it's a good thing. I think that kids generally just have a bit too much access to the internet, and there's a lot of really terrible influences online.
I make nail polish for boys. Nail polish, it's not very accepting for guys. Some people get bullied, will get targeted. My
brand. But not everyone is so upbeat. Lucas Lane is known as Glossy Boys online, sharing tips for boys who like wearing nail polish. He started at just 12 and has grown a community as well as a business. He and his mum Brianna, who helps him, think the ban is badly thought out.
First, I just didn't think it was a threat because, you know, it's just angry old people like, oh, ban social media. But now this is becoming a threat. And I didn't feel consulted. My mum, did you feel consulted?
Absolutely not.
This is affecting me, not the people making this law.
if you have a blanket ban, what you're doing is you're taking choices away from young people.
I want to see kids off their devices and onto the footy fields and the swimming pools and the tennis courts.
It was back in September that Prime Minister Anthony Albanese first mooted the idea of a social media ban. The proposal captured attention. Governments across the world are all grappling with the same issues of how best to protect children online. Dr. Catherine Page-Jeffrey from the University of Sydney says it's the wrong approach.
We need to bring in young people, and of course we need to acknowledge the rights, the perspectives, the agency of young people. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child points out that young people are entitled to participation and that all these things apply to the digital world as well. And everyone seems to be forgetting that.
Many people want to know how it'll work. The government said the companies will be legally required to protect Australians from harm. They've now got a big chunk of time to come up with ways of doing that. Age verification is one suggestion. Daniel Angus is the Professor of Digital Communication at the Queensland University of Technology.
So there are two kinds of age verification that might be put into play. One is age verification proper, which is the handing over of personal details like passports, driver's licence, other forms of ID. That's problematic. In some ways, we're asking all of Australia to hand over those details if they want to be online, not just children. The other technology being talked about is age assurance, and that's the use of facial recognition or other kinds of AI. That is riddled with error. It still carries racial bias, gender bias, age bias, and is not a solution to this issue.
Hi, I'm Taylor, and I'd like to tell you a story about the time I accidentally shared way too much online.
The government said the ban is just one course of action. Media literacy and education is still an important part of protecting kids online.
The big reason that I am pro-ban is because we're having conversation about it.
Kira Pendergast is the director of Safe on Social, an online safety education company who speaks to thousands of students every week.
And other governments are going, oh, what are they doing? And how can we all do this together? And if the collective total of world governments look at this as a positive move and maybe they'll do it, and that pressure goes back towards those companies or changes in legislation in the US, that's also going to be a really positive thing.
It's silly selfie time!
I didn't want to do anything wrong, but I really wanted to have fun with Jane. If you were in my shoes, what would you do?
Australia's touting it as a world-first ban. Who will be next? But perhaps more importantly, how will the platform step up to the new restrictions?
Be careful what you share on the internet, because once it's out there, it's out there. Thanks for listening to my story. Have fun online and be safe.
Katie Watson reporting there from Australia. It's 25 past seven and time for a bit of business news with Will Bain, who's here with us in the studio in London. And Will, I think we just got some numbers in on the government finances.
Yeah, we absolutely did, Amol. Public sector debt, so these borrowing figures that we have, so the amount the government borrows as opposed to what it brings in tax receipts, up significantly. So we were obviously expecting it to rise. We know that. Rachel Reeves is kind of flagging it in the budget, but up much more significantly than we expected. So economists were kind of thinking it would come in at around 13 billion, come in much higher than that. It's come in closer to the 17 billion pound mark. In fact, 17.4 billion pounds in October, 1.6 billion higher than this time last year, and the second highest October borrowing since records began in 1993.
Squeaky bum time in the Treasury. I mean, that's a significant rise in borrowing. It suggests the finances are even more strained than thought. And that's at a time when we've got inflation numbers that were slightly worse.
Yeah, and that's the important bit here. And it's elements like the cost of servicing that debt. So remember, we were talking about that during the budget. That up again, more than £9 billion we're paying every year just to pay off, you know, the interest on those debts as well. And the suggestion from a couple of economists that I've had a very quick chat to, because we've just had the numbers, are suggesting that those public sector pay rises we've seen are part of a little bit of this, and also weaker consumption. So we're making less money from VAT receipts because consumer confidence has been down. Again, we were talking about a lot about that, weren't we? The sort of mood music in the run-up to that budget, people tightening their belts a little bit as well.
In the end, the solution is growth, and that's what they need.
Well,
that's what we all need.
Yeah, there's that for sure.
Yeah. All right. Will Bain, very good to talk to you. Thank you very much, Dean. Will Bain there with the latest on the public sector finances.
27 minutes past seven. Mike's here, the latest on the sport.
Thank you, Emma. Chelsea are through to the quarterfinals of the Women's Champions League. They swept aside Celtic 3-0 last night at Stamford Bridge for their 11th straight victory of the season in all competitions. Arsenal and Manchester City are in Champions League action later this evening. But now let's talk about a story we first brought you at this time yesterday. The news that this man is staying as manager of the Premier League champions.
I'm being happy, comfortable here. I have everything where I need to do my job as best as possible. So I love my job and I have everything to do it. I cannot be in better place right now to feel like still I can do my job. When the feeling will disappear, we'll make a step aside.
Well, that was Pep Guardiola speaking to the media a few years ago after he signed his last contract extension as manager of Manchester City. But now the Spaniard has committed his future once again to the Premier League champions, agreeing a further 12-month deal to keep him at City until June 2026. Guardiola has won 6 Premier League titles in his 8 years at City. He also won the club's first ever Champions League title last year, so can fans expect more of the same under Pep? The author, Simon Bykowski, has written a book called The Blueprint, all about Guardiola and his success at Manchester City. He joins us now. Morning, Simon.
Morning.
Worth saying, isn't it, that Manchester City are yet to officially confirm this news, but we are taking it as read that Guardiola has agreed a new contract extension. What do you think has convinced him to stay?
A few things, really, and the timing, you know, with many different aspects going on. He was approached by England in the summer and there have been other opportunities. But I think starting this season at Manchester City, he wasn't convinced he had the energy to carry on, but he has shown that. And more than anything, you know, as kind of touched on in the book, the support network that he has at Manchester City, there is no better place in world football for him to manage. And he continues to have kind of everything at his disposal to be able to get the best out of himself. And that, you know, pushes him on to keep on winning.
He almost has complete autonomy, doesn't he, over the whole setup at Manchester City. Slightly ironic, though, Simon, do you think that this news has come in the middle of Pep Guardiola's worst run as a manager? City have lost 4 games in a row. That doesn't happen very often.
It doesn't, no. It's never happened before under Guardiola. And, you know, the fact that 4 losses is the worst run says how consistent they've been. There was a similar situation in 2020 when they were playing really, really poorly. And then he signed his contract. They lost the next game. And then I think they went on a 30-game unbeaten run and they won the league. So, you know, City needed something in this international break. And even the timing of it could be said to be, you know, the boost that the team will need that Guardiola is providing again.
He has signed a contract extension, but do you think this might still be the start of the long goodbye? 2026 will take him to a decade at Manchester City, won't it? Do you think it's unlikely that we'll see him extend his stay beyond that?
I don't think anyone can say, really. You know, nobody thought he would stay more than 3 years, and he didn't think he would stay that long. He certainly didn't think he would stay a decade. You know, he has got ambitions to manage internationally. And so 2026 will be the start of a European or a World Cup cycle. But, you know, at the end of last season, there were many people convinced that he would leave at the end of this season, and he hasn't. You can't pigeonhole him. And so, you know, he will go on till the end of 2026, and then we will have this conversation again and see if he extends again. But it's, the longer he stays, you know, the bigger the legacy he builds for himself and for Manchester City.
Yeah, the Pep Guardiola era continues at the Etihad. Got to leave it there. But Simon Bykowski, who is the author of The Blueprint, Inside Manchester City and the Guardiola Project, that's a book out now. Many thanks for your time. Briefly, one tennis line to leave you with. Italy are the Billie Jean King Cup winners. They beat Slovakia 2-0 in the final yesterday, winning both singles rubbers in straight sets.
Mike, thank you very much indeed. Next week, a new series helps explain how to avoid being scammed.
On BBC Radio 4.
It was my stupid mistake. I just helped ruin someone's life.
I'm Shari Vaal. I've been investigating fraud for decades.
I was adding up this in my head and I thought, that's everything. I've lost everything.
In my new series, I'm sharing five of my stories that'll keep you and those around you safe from the scammers.
What have I done that has caused this particular situation? You begin to doubt yourself.
Five Ways They Get You, with me, Shari Vaal. Part of the BBC Scam Safe season on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Monday to Friday at 11:45.
Let's now have a look at the weather. Dry and bright for most of today, but scattered sleet and snow showers in the northwest and north. Cloudier for southwest England and far southern Wales, with spells of rain and hill snow in places.
And coming up in just over 15 minutes' time, the charity Watchdog has published its report into the family of Captain Sir Tom Moore. We'll hear from the Charity Commission for England and Wales on their findings at 10 to 8. And then at 10 past 8, Gordon Brown on the life and legacy of John Prescott.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett. It's now 27 minutes to 8, and we can have a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
The former Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott, who was a major figure in the Labour Party for decades, has died at the age of 86. His family said he'd been living with Alzheimer's. He was an important bridge between the traditional Labour left and the modernising faction of the party. Sir Tony Blair, under whose government Lord Prescott spent a decade as Deputy Prime Minister, said he was devastated by his passing and called him one of the most talented people he'd ever encountered in politics. The former US Vice President Al Gore, who worked with Mr. Prescott on the Kyoto Climate Change Agreement, said he possessed an inherent ability to connect with people about the issues that mattered to them. A report by the Charity Commission says the family of Captain Sir Tom Moore refused to donate any of the £1.5 million received from a book deal to his foundation. It also says there were repeated incidents of misconduct by his daughter and her husband. The couple says the Commission's report is unfair. Government borrowing rose to £17.4 billion last month, marking the second highest October figure since monthly records began. The Office for National Statistics said public sector net borrowing was £1.6 billion higher than the same month last year. The water industry regulator Ofwat says nine companies are to be blocked from using customer money to fund bonuses for top bosses worth £6.8 billion. They include Thames Water, which has significant debts. The rate at which children have been suspended from state primary schools in England has more than doubled in the last decade. BBC analysis of data also found exclusions had risen by 70%. Australia has introduced legislation that will ban under-16s from accessing social media. Speaking to Parliament, the Communications Minister, Michelle Rowland, said it was a world-first bill that would protect young Australians at a critical stage in their development. The US government has proposed breaking up Google's monopoly over online searches by making it sell its Chrome search engine. The Department of Justice also wants the firm to stop paying smartphone makers to put Google as their default search browser.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. 25 to 8. Ukraine has used longer-range UK-supplied Storm Shadow missiles against targets inside Russia for the first time. This follows Joe Biden giving President Zelensky the green light to use so-called ATACMS missiles supplied by Washington to strike inside Russia too. And this comes in the week that Russia has launched its biggest aerial attack on Ukraine for almost 3 months. In a moment, we'll speak to Lord Ricketts, Peter Ricketts, former National Security Advisor and Foreign Office boss. First, let's go to Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, who joins us from Moscow. Steve, good morning. You'd normally get, wouldn't you, Steve, a statement from the Kremlin or the defence minister in these circumstances. What have we heard so far? What have you heard in Russia?
Not much. There's been no official reaction, nothing from the Kremlin, nothing from the defence ministry. So far, silence. I mean, apart from Russian pro-war bloggers who reported that the Storm Shadow missiles had hit a target in the village of Marina, in Russia's Kursk region. That's the part of Russia bordering Ukraine where Ukrainian troops have seized a chunk of territory. Various images have been posted online, unverified, showing fragments of a missile. But last night, I watched the main nightly news bulletin on Russian TV, Vremya. No mention at all of what had happened, and only very low down in the bulletin a reference to events earlier in the week, to Ukraine launching those US-supplied attack and missiles at an arms depot in Russia's Bryansk region.
Well, what will they be thinking, Steve, in the Kremlin about how they can use this period between Biden's sort of exit and Trump taking American power in January the 20th? How might Russia use this period to strengthen its position, both militarily and in any future negotiation?
I wonder what they're thinking. I wonder what President Putin is thinking right now. You know, the contrast between past rhetoric and the current reaction we've seen this week is really noticeable. You know, for months, Putin has been signalling that strikes on Russian territory with these Western longer-range missiles is a big fat red line, right, for the Kremlin. He said that back in June. He said he would see it as the direct participation of the countries supplying those weapons in a war with Russia. He said it again in September. And this week, of course, we got that Kremlin decree lowering the nuclear threshold, allowing for a Russian nuclear strike if its territory was attacked by a non-nuclear power with weapons provided by a nuclear power. And yet, the use of ATACMS and Storm Shadow is not at all dominating the news bulletins, far from it. And it's been really interesting reading the Russian papers on this week. One paper yesterday had a retired lieutenant colonel who was asked, how should Russia react to these longer-range missiles being fired at Bryansk region? And his reply, starting World War III over a missile attack on an arms depot in Bryansk region would be short-sighted,
right,
which is, of course, the understatement of the year. I think an attempt to play things down here as President Putin tries to work out how to respond to this, knowing that Donald Trump will be in the White House in 2 months' time, an American president who has sort of praised him in the past.
Yeah. Steve Rosenberg in Moscow, thank you. Let's turn to Lord Ricketts. Peter, good morning. I should say, of course, former National Security Advisor. Isn't the truth, Lord Ricketts, that while this is often described as an attritional conflict, Russia is making significant advances and gains, and if one side is winning, it's not Ukraine, it's not the Democratic West?
Good morning, Amal. Well, it's certainly true over the last few months that Russia has been grinding its way kilometre by kilometre forward in Ukraine. And I think this decision, which I welcome, I think it's overdue from the US and the British to allow these longer range missiles to be used against legitimate targets, military targets in Russia, is a signal that Western backers of Ukraine are not giving up. It's a psychological boost to the Ukrainians. It complicates Russian decision making about where to place their forces. So I'm not surprised in a way that they are deciding to play this down a bit. They don't have any very useful options to escalate. They've been trying to get us all into a position of accepting it was fine for the Russians to fire Iranian drones, North Korean missiles from the safety of their own territory right across Ukraine. And yet, when the West gives Ukraine the capacity to respond, then they say that's a reckless escalation. In practice, they don't have a lot that they can do about it. And so I suspect they're not making as big a deal as they might have done all along the line. When we've given them a new capability for Ukraine to use, the Russians have first of all said this is a big fat red line and then actually found there's not much they can do about it.
How does this war end?
Well, all wars end in the end. Zelensky has been beginning to say that 2025 is going to be the year of negotiation. He can see Trump coming into the White House, Trump saying that he's going to impose a settlement very quickly. So while we should go on supporting Ukraine as long as they're prepared to keep fighting, it is absolutely right that we should begin to think about how this war ends in a way that preserves, safeguards Ukraine's vital interests. To me, I think we've got to get to Trump quickly to say, you like to end wars, but you also like to look strong. The way to look strong is to make sure that Ukraine comes out of this with its interests safeguarded. That means a deal, first of all, with Ukraine, not against it, not over its head. Secondly, that doesn't require it to cede sovereignty over the territory that Russia will continue to hold if there's a ceasefire, that the status of that is left open. And crucially, that Ukraine gets to decide its security policy in the period after a ceasefire so it can continue to work towards NATO membership. If you had a deal like that, I mean, yes, it would still be an unsatisfactory outcome, but it would be a ceasefire that allowed Ukraine to continue to draw closer to the West.
It's so interesting you outline those three aims of any negotiation. But on the second one, which you outline there, Peter, about territory, a lot of our listeners might say, you know, Ukraine's a sovereign democratic nation. It's been invaded and reinvaded illegally. Thousands of innocent Ukrainians, including children, have been slaughtered. Some of the great cities of Europe have been flattened. And it's not just Russia. It's Russia backed by North Korea and Iran here. In these circumstances, wouldn't allowing Putin to have a single inch of Ukrainian soil be tantamount to capitulation?
I mean, people will say that, and they are quite right. And of course, the ideal outcome would be to push the Russians off every centimeter of Ukrainian territory that they have illegally occupied. But realistically, Amol, is that going to happen? I mean, the West has been giving Ukraine about $100 billion a year in military and economic aid for the last 2.5 years. I mean, that is only going to go one way, I'm afraid, in the future, with Trump saying he might withdraw American military aid. I mean, I think as well as having principles, we have to be realistic. And if you think to the history, you know, Germany was divided, but the long-term future of Germany was never conceded and eventually it was unified. I think if you accept as a reality the occupation by Russia a part of Ukraine, you absolutely don't accept they have any right to it, and you leave the long-term status open to work out in the future. I mean, that at least gets this attritional war over for now, and then it's up to the West to make sure Ukraine stays strong, and let's leave the future to sort out the eventual outcome of this completely illegal invasion.
Lord Ricketts, Peter Ricketts, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
It's 17 minutes to eight. I don't think I've ever met anybody quite like John. The words of former Prime Minister Sir Tony Blair to us half an hour ago as he marked the death of Lord Prescott. Sir Tony said John Prescott had played a vital part in keeping the show on the road for three terms of Labour governments. But he also affectionately described the unique character of his deputy, embodied perhaps none more so when he punched a protester during the 2001 election campaign.
Some people were saying, well, look, he's deputy prime minister, you know, he kind of a deputy prime minister thumping a voter. And then there were other people said, yeah, but, you know, he had this egg slammed in his head and he turned around and whacked the guy. And a lot of people will think, well, fair enough. And so there was nothing you could do. So we had a long debate about it. And finally, at the press conference, when I was asked about it, I just said, well, John is John. And everyone said, was that supposed to be an answer? And I said, yeah, that's an answer. That's as much as you can say. And that's what he was like. He didn't. There were no rules that he really abided by.
Tony Blair talking to us just about half an hour ago. If you missed that interview, you can listen back to it in full. He's very emotional about it. He talks of being devastated. He said he was still talking to him in the last few weeks of his life, speaking on a video conference. He was also remembering some of his political achievements, as well as some unique talents of balancing a cup and saucer on his tummy, not least in the company of Prince Charles, as he was now His Majesty. Chris Mason, our political editor, is here. Chris, what's the reaction like from those who are paying tribute this morning? And what do you think the best way is to reflect on and understand John Prescott's contribution to politics?
A huge reaction, morning to you, Emma, as you might imagine. And I think there's a prism, you know, through which you can examine John Prescott's life, his politics and his career. And that prism is social class. A lot of people are going to reflect on the kind of authentic grit, if you like, that John Prescott brought to the soundbitey middle-class polish of New Labour. But there's a story much earlier which illustrates how it ran as a strand throughout his entire career. 1957, John Prescott was 19 years old and he was working as a waiter on a cruise ship. It was called the Rangi Tata. And he and it were sailing to New Zealand. And one of their passengers was Anthony Eden, who just resigned as Prime Minister, who was to be the waiter to the former Prime Minister, the future Deputy Prime Minister. John Prescott was to entertain the passengers in a boxing match. Anthony Eden was the judge of that match. John Prescott won. The former Prime Minister giving Mr. Prescott 2 hours overtime and 2 bottles of beer. And the two warmed to each other. But John Prescott reflected that it was very much the kind of upstairs, downstairs experience. He's top class, I'm bottom class, is how he described it. And then much later, decades later, there was a picture hanging in the office of 26 Whitehall, John Prescott's office as Deputy Prime Minister. What was it? It was a picture of the Rangitata, that ship, which was in the government's art collection. And I think that story from 1957, it tells you the prism through which so many, including Mr. Prescott himself, Lord Prescott, saw where he sat relative to much of those around him, and if not the unique, then certainly the distinctive blend that he could then bring to the new Labour project decades later.
And do you think because of that, and also what Tony Blair was talking about with, you know, he wasn't just wanting to stay where he was, he understood the aspirations of working class people as well. Do you think because of that he changed politics, he changed the Commons, he paved the way for others?
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, there had been other prominent working class figures, of course, in the House of Commons, but to rise to the top of a project in the kind of rebranding, remoulding of the Labour Party and its attempt under Tony Blair to appeal to a far wider swathe of the population, to reach into a middle Britain it had previously struggled to connect with. He was part of that binding agent with Labour's traditional voter base, that binding agent between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, who had a sort of famously fractious relationship, and trying to personify that sense, as Tony Blair was saying to us half an hour or so ago, of the aspiration of those he was so keen to continually authentically represent as a long-standing MP in Hull to better themselves. And as Tony Blair attempted to articulate, did set out, didn't he, that in many senses was the personification of the project, indeed.
Chris Mason, I'm going to have to leave it there. Thank you.
Time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Rabbi Laura Jana Klausner, executive coach and rabbi of Bromley Reform Synagogue.
Good morning. This week, I was struck by reports about the US government agreeing to provide anti-personnel landmines to Ukraine. Those destructive weapons signal a new stage in the conflict as the outgoing president tries to bolster Ukraine's war effort. At the same time, horrendous wars in Israel, Gaza, Lebanon, and in the occupied Palestinian territories are killing tens of thousands there, but also wreaking damage to relationships here. We're fortunate to be at peace as a country, but not necessarily as people, because of the effects of these overseas wars. Witnessing wars is qualitatively different now than it ever has been, because of unmediated images of extreme suffering on our televisions and phones, and because so many of us are also attached to other parts of the world. It's better to know the truth, but also to be aware that we ourselves might be changed, damaged, and even brutalized by that experience. What happens in the Middle East doesn't stay in the Middle East. Often, empathy seems reserved for some people and not others. Palestine or Israel, Jews or Muslims. There's a caustic fantasy that people are all good or all evil. 36 times the Torah commands the Jewish people to have empathy, to treat others properly, because we were that other, strangers and slaves in ancient Egypt, and God is definitive. If you mistreat them, I will listen to their outcry as soon as they cry out to me. I'll listen, for I'm compassionate. Landmines are horrendous weapons of war. Metaphorical landmines of past conflicts lurk hidden under the surface, harbouring destruction for generations. We may be turning the landmines of overseas wars into anti-personal, anti-social destructive landmines here that will threaten to detonate for decades to come unless we map them right now and disarm them. And there's one sure method to disarm these compassion and empathy-suppressing landmines. Curiosity. Curiosity is the ultimate disarming tool. The power of questions, of doubt, the diffusing effect of one modest question. I wonder why they do that, think that, respond that way. Do you really think that? Suppressing of empathy is our own weapon of psychological warfare, our own internalised landmine. It might enable soldiers to fight on the battlefield, but far away, when we suppress empathy, when we don't ask about others, we damage ourselves, our sense of self, and capacity to be in our own pain, anger, and sadness. Let's not let the impact of wars abroad lay a minefield for our future relations here.
That was Thought for the Day with Rabbi Laura Jana Klausner. It is 9 minutes to 8. The late Sir Captain Tom Moore raised nearly £40 million walking laps of his garden for the NHS during the pandemic. But today, a long-awaited report into the charity that bears his name has found that his daughter and her husband mismanaged the foundation and that there were repeated incidents of misconduct. The Charity Commission said that they damaged public trust in charities by refusing to donate any of the £1.4 million received from the late 100-year-old Army veterans book deal. Back in October 2023, Captain Tom's daughter, Hannah Ingram Moore, told Talk TV's Piers Morgan's Uncensored programme that there had been no agreement with her father that the book money would go to charity.
Remember that he wrote these books. He started writing them fairly early on, just as the war had finished. Mm. And they were all signed off. He'd finished them by the June of 2020. Mm. They were never anything to do with the charity.
That's Hannah Ingram Moore talking. I should say we invited her onto the programme this morning to respond to this report, which has been described as damning by the Charity Commission, but we didn't hear back. I'll reflect her comments on the report in just a moment, but David Holdsworth, the Charity Commission's chief executive, has joined us. Good morning.
Good morning.
This has been going on for some time, these investigations. What was the concern about this foundation?
So I think all of us remember fondly Captain Sir Tom's efforts and fundraising efforts during the pandemic and the smile it brought to our face and the extraordinary amount of funds he raised, that £39 million. All of that went to NHS Charities Together. So this is not about that first fundraising effort. This is about the charity subsequently set up in his name, which didn't follow his sense of duty, service and others before self.
What have you found?
What we found, there was a repeated blurring of the lines between the private interests of the Ingram Moores and the charity. So the book deal, which was mentioned, £1.4 million was paid in an advance. The advertising, the marketing, and indeed Captain Sir Tom Moore's own words in the prologue, that he was grateful to have the opportunity to raise funds for his foundation, we believe would have led the public to believe that some of that money would go to the charity. In fact, it didn't. It went to the Ingram Moores.
And beyond that particular example, what else have you found? There's a catalogue, it seems, of mismanagement.
There is. There's a repeated pattern of behaviour. There was also an agreement made with an award ceremony. Now, Mrs. Ingram Moore was the CEO of the charity at that time, but the trustees were unaware of that agreement. And what that agreement led to was an £18,000 payment to Mrs. Ingram Moore and only a £2,000 payment to the charity. Now, had the trustees been aware, they might have negotiated a different deal that saw the charity benefit more.
When I look at what the Ingram Moore family have said in response to your conclusions, they say they've been treated unfairly and unjustly. They describe the process as excessive. They've accused your watchdog of having a predetermined agenda, and they say we remain dedicated to upholding Captain Sir Tom's legacy and want the public to know there has never been any misappropriation of funds. What do you say to that?
So we'd absolutely refute any suggestion that we weren't balanced or fair. We're an independent regulator. We follow the evidence and we follow the law. And as the public will see when they read our evidence in that report, they can make their own minds up.
When you think about what should happen next then, what can happen? What is possible? Is there ability to have donations, I don't know, returned, refunded for money to go back into the charity?
So what we've done is we've taken robust action in disqualifying the Ingram Moores for a period of 10 years and 8 years respectively. So they won't be able to operate or lead charities for those periods. In terms of the funds, then that's now a matter for the trustees, and we stand ready to provide advice as they consider their next steps.
So I suppose, just to understand, do you have confidence in the trustees who are there to administer this properly? Is this a charity that's fit to work, to act, to use the money that is still remaining?
So the trustees that are there now have engaged with us, and we've provided regulatory advice which we expect them to follow and which we will monitor.
I suppose it's how you stop this happening in the first place. There's one thing of having the response and investigating, but what's your view on that looking across the charity sector?
So there's 170,000 charities in England and Wales. The vast majority do a brilliant job day in, day out. Mm. They make a massive difference to people's lives, from air ambulances saving people to sea rescues to education charities. They make a massive difference. It very rarely goes wrong. When it does, as the regulator, we're there to step in so the public can have confidence in charity.
Because there is that risk that we talked about there about the public losing faith in charities from this sort of action that you've described, not least with, you know, talking about the book and the amount of money there.
And that's why it's important. Our research tells us that transparency is really important to members of the public for their trust in charities, as well as having an independent regulator that regulates robustly. So when it does go wrong, we will step in.
David Holdsworth, the Charity Commission's Chief Executive. Thank you.
Take a moment with BBC Radio 3 Unwind, the new destination for music to unwind your mind. Set yourself up for the morning with Dr. Sian Williams' selection of soothing classical tracks. And join Oliver Arnold's as you wind down in the evening with ultimate calm.
Music that can bring complete peace of mind.
Radio 3 Unwind. Listen on BBC Sound.
Complete peace of mind. Simon King's here with the weather. Hello, Simon.
Very calming. Not so much, I guess, though, if you're travelling in the southwest of England this morning. We have got some heavy snow causing some disruption. Even down to low levels, there is a good covering of snow in places. The rain, sleet and snow is much heavier, and that's why there is much more of it coming down to low levels. It's pushed eastward into parts of southeast England. So the South Downs also now getting some snow falling at the moment. This snow is likely to continue for a good few more hours, really only clearing after lunchtime to the southeast, where there'll be some sunny spells eventually developing. But yes, quite a few hazards this morning across southern England, and maximum temperatures today getting up to about 1 to 4 degrees. I should also note as well, actually, some very strong winds in the southwest with some gales for a time during the morning. Now for Wales, Midlands and eastern England, we've got some of that rain, sleet and snow coming its way into parts of South Wales, just brushing the South Midlands as well for a time. But otherwise, though, it's dry. There'll be some sunny spells, a few winter showers coming into north west Wales today, and then later into the evening, perhaps northwest England as well. A bit of snow over the higher ground, maybe down to low levels. Temperatures are 1 to 3 Celsius. Across northern England today, cold and frosty. Temperatures still as low as minus 6 to minus 8 degrees. Lots of dry and fairly sunny weather as well. I mentioned one or two showers coming into parts of northwest England. Those could be wintry. Temperatures of 2 to 5 degrees. And for Scotland and Northern Ireland, frequent snow showers continuing to pile in across the far north and the west of Scotland. Significant accumulations expected here. Some winter showers also for Northern Ireland. Otherwise, they're dry with some sunshine. Again, cold temperatures 1 to 4 Celsius. Tonight, again, there'll be further winter showers northern Scotland, parts of Wales, northern England. Frosty again into Friday. Plenty of dry weather on Friday, but turning very wet, very windy, potentially very snowy as well for many on Saturday. So stay tuned.
Diamond, thank you. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan.
It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 21st of November. Good morning if you're just joining us. The headlines: the former Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott, a towering figure in the Labour Party for several decades, has died at the age of 86. Ever the campaigner, Lord Prescott, as he became, leaves a mark on the party few can match.
I'll not be leaving the political fight. I'll never leave the political fight. I'll never give up campaigning for the Labour Party. Yes, I'll be swapping me government jag for this bus pass to campaign for Labour.
An hour ago, we heard from Sir Tony Blair, who's deputy too. And after the news, another former Prime Minister joins us, Gordon Brown, who pays his own tribute to John Prescott.
In private conversations, there was a warmth that people never quite saw, because they saw him as a trade unionist with uncompromising toughness, when in fact he was gentle and generous in real life.
In other news, a report by the Charity Commission has strongly criticised the family of Captain Sir Tom Moore. They have called the findings unfair. There's been a bigger than expected rise in government borrowing. Still to come on the programme, we'll speak to the head of the water regulator on what they're doing to prevent company bosses from receiving bonuses. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
The former Deputy Prime Minister, Lord Prescott, who was a major figure in the Labour Party for decades, has died at the age of 86. He'd had a stroke in 2019 and his family said he'd been living with Alzheimer's. John Prescott provided an important link between Labour's traditional left wing in the trade union movement and the modernising faction of the party. Our political correspondent Ben Wright looks back at his life.
As the Labour Party modernised under John Smith and Tony Blair, John Prescott was a proud working class bridge to its past. A former ship's steward, he had deep roots in the trade union movement.
I came out of 10 years of seafaring that taught me all the industrial strength and the industrial muscle, couldn't achieve all that I wanted, that I needed a political party to make the changes to achieve the...
In office, Blair valued his deputy's loyalty, and John Prescott played a key role mediating the fractious relationship between the Prime Minister and his Chancellor Gordon Brown.
He has got very, very great strength.
John is John. That was Tony Blair's affectionately rueful reaction when his deputy punched an egg-throwing protester during the 2001 general election. It cemented John Prescott's reputation as a no-nonsense political bruiser. Following Labour's landslide in 1997, Prescott ran a huge department that spanned transport, planning and the environment. He played a key role setting up the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. Famously fond of his Jaguar cars, the man dubbed Two Jags in office revealed he had ditched them when he appeared at the COP climate summit in 2021. John Prescott's contortions with the English language were often mocked by a press he seemed to loathe, but he brought colour and conviction to the new Labour Party.
Sir Keir Starmer called Lord Prescott a true giant of the Labour movement and said his honesty was respected across the political divide. The former US Vice President Al Gore, who worked with him on the Kyoto Climate Change Agreement, said he possessed an inherent ability to connect with people about the issues that mattered to them. Sir Tony Blair told this programme that he was devastated by John Prescott's death and that he had a huge, genuine affection for him. Sir Tony said there was nobody quite like him in British politics.
He was actually an innovator. He was highly, highly intelligent. That was sometimes masked by, you know, people used to make fun of his speeches and his use of the English language. But he was an incredibly direct communicator. And even if the syntax never quite made sense, the sentiment was very powerful and made complete sense. He was loyal, committed, an enormous help to me. And he had a fantastic gut instinct about politics.
Our political editor Chris Mason considers Lord Prescott's singular approach and his lasting impact.
The completely unique Prescott blend of charm and brutality, made always more effective by the unpredictability of which would be predominant, got you through the decade. So wrote Tony Blair in a private letter to John Prescott in the days after leaving Downing Street as Prime Minister in 2007. Amid the slick middle-class polish of New Labour, John Prescott personified a blunt grit, proudly working class, proud of his trades union background, proud to bind his party's past with its present. From a seafaring waiter as a young man, he was, via the European Parliament and much later the House of Lords, to become the country's longest-serving Deputy Prime Minister.
A highly critical report by the Charity Commission has said the family of Captain Sir Tom Moore received almost £1.5 million from a book deal, but repeatedly refused to give any of it to the foundation set up in his name. Captain Sir Tom raised money for the NHS during lockdown by walking laps of his garden. The war veteran's daughter and son-in-law have been banned from being charity trustees for 10 and 8 years, respectively. Here's our investigations correspondent, Joe Pike.
Captain Sir Tom Moore raised £39 million, which all went to NHS charities. But it's the actions of his daughter Hannah and her husband Colin which the Charity Commission has said amounts to misconduct, mismanagement or both. It said they repeatedly personally benefited from the charity that was set up in his name, including the money from a deal for 3 books. The publisher and promoter of those books said the family gave repeated assurances that part of the advance would be used to set up and fund the Captain Tom Foundation. The charity has yet to receive any of it. The Ingramores have said this report has treated them unfairly, the process was unjust and excessive, and the Charity Commission had a predetermined agenda. The Captain Tom Foundation, which is now likely to be closed down, said it implored the Ingram Moores to return the funds due to the foundation so they could be donated to well-deserving charities.
The water industry regulator Ofwat says nine companies will be stopped from using customer money to pay millions of pounds in what it called undeserved bonuses for senior executives. Three firms, Thames Water, Yorkshire Water and Dŵr Cymru Welsh Water, were directly blocked using new powers given to Ofwat. A further six companies had voluntarily decided not to push the cost of executive bonuses onto customers, with shareholders paying instead. New figures show that government borrowing was much higher than expected in October, with the difference between income and spending reaching £17.4 billion. That's the second highest deficit recorded for any October since monthly figures began in 1993. Here's our chief economics correspondent, Darshini David.
This is a disappointing set of figures for the Chancellor, coming just weeks after the budget. The increase in the deficit reflects both record interest payments on debt for any October and higher spending on items such as wages, as the pay rises agreed by Rachel Reeves are registered in the numbers. That was not compensated for by an increase in tax receipts. The government has responded by saying its budget put the public finances on a sustainable footing. But these figures, while preliminary, suggest the pattern of overspending seen earlier in the financial year may be continuing. If that is sustained, the tax measures unveiled last month may not be the last, despite what Ms. Reeves has suggested, if the government is to achieve its spending priorities.
The Defence Secretary, John Healey, will be questioned by MPs today after it emerged that Ukraine had fired British-supplied missiles into Russia for the first time. The government has so far not commented to confirm or deny the use of the weapons. The US has allowed Ukraine to use missiles it has supplied to hit targets in Russia and has now approved almost $300 million of further military aid. There's been a surge in the rate at which children are being suspended or excluded permanently from state primary schools in England. The BBC analysed data from the last 10 years and found that suspensions had more than doubled, while exclusions had risen by 70%. Last year, there were 84,000 suspensions compared with 38,000 a decade ago. The most common reason for being suspended or excluded was persistent disruptive behaviour. Australia has introduced legislation that will ban under-16s from accessing social media. Speaking to Parliament, the Communications Minister, Michelle Rowland, said it was a world-first bill that would protect young Australians at a critical stage in their development. Our Sydney correspondent, Katie Watson, reports.
The government says this new bill is about protecting young people, not punishing or isolating them. Under the new proposals, nobody under the age of 16 will have access to social media apps like Instagram and TikTok, but initially messaging apps and online gaming, as well as platforms used for education and health purposes, will be excluded from the ban. The onus won't be on parents or users to comply, it'll be on the social media companies, who now have at least a year to come up with ways of preventing young people from accessing the platforms. If they fail to do so, they face fines as high as £26 million. The bill will need to pass both houses before it becomes law and is expected to go to the Senate next week.
Lawyers for the US Department of Justice have proposed sweeping changes at the technology giant Google, including selling off its internet browser Chrome. They're in response to a landmark ruling this summer in which a federal judge found the company was operating an illegal monopoly in online searches. Our North American technology correspondent Lee Jamali has more.
U.S. government lawyers say Google's web browser Chrome is a key access point that funnels users to its search engine. Another recommendation would bar Google from entering into contracts with the likes of Apple and Samsung to make Google's search engine the default on smartphones and in browsers. In response to the filing, Google said that the Department of Justice, with its proposals, had chosen to push what it called a radical interventionist agenda that harmed America's global technology leadership. The company will set out its counterproposals next month. A judge will rule on the case next year.
Lily Jamali reporting.
Jane, thank you. The time now is 8:10. I always wanted to do this. Those were the words of a smiling John Prescott on the doorstep of Number 10 when Tony Blair's first cabinet strode up Downing Street in 1997. He had taken the most unlikely route, Born in North Wales before the outbreak of the war, his family moved to Rotherham and Chester. He failed the 11 plus, which left him humiliated. He had been promised a bike if he passed the exam. It never came. The young John wrote a love letter to a girl he fancied. She sent it back with the spelling mistakes highlighted, in an era when his dyslexia wouldn't have been diagnosed, still less understood. I have to live with the lack of education in my life daily, in the way I string words together in the House of Commons, he once said. He may sometimes have mangled his sentences, but he remained one of Labour's great communicators, not least on this programme.
You're a programme of depression at the moment. When I listen to your programme, Evan, you come on. You're always predicting the misery, the end of the world. Gordon Brown's no gone. You've been bloody wrong all the time and you'll be wrong again.
John Prescott has died at the age of 86. In the end, his chief contribution to national life was, in his own estimation, as a kind of personal and ideological glue between the two pillars of New Labour. An hour ago, Sir Tony Blair told us that there were no rules that John Prescott abided by, most obviously when he punched an egg-throwing protester in the middle of the 2001 election campaign. Prescott joked that he was just connecting with the electorate. Sir Tony told us about his friend's unusually effective political antennae.
He had this extraordinary instinctive sense that something was afoot. And he often used to come in unannounced into my room in Downing Street, and he would say to me, "I know you're up to something. I don't know quite what it is, but I know you're up to something." And I would be sort of protesting and saying, "No, John, no, you got it all wrong." And he said, "No, I haven't." And of course, he'd always be right. I would be up to something. But, you know, if we had a difficult issue, we'd talk about it. He was often, you know, presenting a different point of view. But once we came to a decision, he got behind it.
Well, that was Tony Blair. And I spoke a short time ago to Gordon Brown, and I invited him to reflect on the life and legacy of John Prescott.
John was a friend of mine. He was a colleague. But, you know, when you think of him, he was a colossus. He was a titan of the Labour movement. John Lennon talked about working class hero. It's difficult to fit that term, but I think John would like that an adjective spoken of him. You've got to look at his achievements. You know, he was probably the first government minister to see the importance of the environment. So Kyoto, that environmental treaty in 1997, you've got to attribute that to John's hard work with Al Gore. Then he saw the importance, and he was a pioneer of regional policy. So the fact we have devolution and mayors owes a great deal to what John was thinking right throughout the 1980s and 90s when I was actually working with him. And then we mustn't forget that one of the great achievements of John as Environment Secretary was the repair and improvement of housing. 1.5 million houses would not have been repaired without John's determination that the social housing stock had to be re-modernised. So you've got to look at the practical achievements of someone who possibly surprised himself by the way that he managed to become Deputy Prime Minister, but actually made a huge difference. And as Deputy Prime Minister, I think you've got to remember that throughout all these difficult times, he was a unifying force. You know, he started off fighting Harold Wilson in the 1960s. Harold Wilson called him a dangerous left-winger because he was one of the Siemens trade union officials during a famous Siemens strike, which actually disrupted the Labour government of 1966. But then, as deputy leader, he realised, I think, the importance, what Aneurin Bevan said, the passion for unity in the Labour Party, and he was determined that the government, despite all the difficulties, particularly over Iraq, would hold together.
You mentioned Nye Bevan. Of course, it was Ernest Bevin who was one of his great working class heroes. You also mentioned his role in the unity of the Labour government. It's interesting this morning, looking back over the clips and hearing the archive, how often he referred to himself as a marriage counsellor between you and Tony Blair. Beyond the ministerial posts, what role did he play in making New Labour work?
Well, I think the marriage counselling is a bit overdone. But I've talked to John in these last few months, and what always has come out for me is the warmth and his sense that he was part of a team. You know, he got into great trouble, remember, during one of the general elections when he punched someone who had thrown an egg at him. And he was a boxer. But, you know, what he wanted to do was to see people working together. He realised you cannot succeed in government unless you can actually come to clear decisions. That's what he kept pushing for. You know, on Iraq was an incredibly difficult issue for people, and I think it still remains a very difficult issue. And mistakes were obviously made, but John was determined that the government would hold together. So, despite his image as a tough person who was perhaps uncompromising, John was actually the first to want people to work together. I think we've got to remember also that John was very honest about the problems that he had. You know, I think because he talked about it, he had diabetes, and he helped people because he talked about his condition. He had bulimia, which is a very difficult condition attached mainly to women and not men, but he talked about it and got people to think what they might do about it. And now, this morning, I know the family has told the story that John was really suffering from Alzheimer's in his last period of time, and they're saying, look, no flowers, nothing. Please donate to the Alzheimer's Society. And John would want people to think about the kind of conditions that other people were facing, but he wants something to be done.
It's interesting you mentioned his emotional availability. There's also a bit of a cliche about him, isn't there, that because he was of his working class roots and because he came through the trade unions, that he was always necessarily on the left of the Labour Party. But actually, if you look, he was something of a moderniser before people called it modernising the Labour Party or called it New Labour. It was in the 1980s that he talked about using private capital to improve public services. So, in a sense, there was more to his politics than the cliche would allow.
Yeah, John always talked about enduring values in new situations. So the values did not change. Labour was about fairness. It was about justice. It was about matching economic efficiency with social improvement. But it was a new situation. So John was very much aware of how the world was changing. And so his interest in the environment is part of that. You know, he kept that up even after 1997 Kyoto, even when he was no longer a minister. He was still attending conferences abroad. He built up a very strong relationship with China to get them to do something on the environment. And as you've said, Al Gore paid tribute to everything that he's done. He saw the importance of improving our infrastructure and felt that you had to mobilize private capital for public purposes. And he explained that to the Labour Party, which was quite difficult about accepting some of that. So massive changes in the way that we saw the world. But John always came back to this idea of enduring values. And I think that was his big contribution, because you could see him speaking to a Labour Party meeting, and you can see him talking to people who were not convinced, and finally winning them over by the power of what was a racy rhetoric. You know, John spoke so fast that sometimes people were struggling to keep up with him.
Yeah.
And so someone said that he was, you know, in a battle with the English language. And I remember this great speech that he did in when John Smith, my friend and someone I grew up with in a way, was trying to win the Labour Party around to this idea of one person, one vote.
1993.
John had run out of ways of getting people to accept that this was a good thing to do. And he had his own friends in the trade union movement opposing him. And this was one of the things that surprised John. And so my friend Murray Elder, who had just died recently, turned to John and said, you've got to get John Prescott in to do this. He's the only person that can persuade the party. And then John made this table-thumping speech that was absolutely brilliant in the sense that it was so passionate. And I'm not sure that anybody remembers the words of it. They remember the passion, and he got a standing ovation, and John won his reform. And so that was one of the ways where, if you like, enduring values, the Labour Party stood for working people, was being represented in new situations. We had to modernise the structure of the Labour Party, and that really saved John Smith's leadership.
And how animated, how angry was he in private conversations when, for instance, those pictures of him playing croquet at Dorneywood came through? Because he, in public, he later said that he felt that he was constantly a victim of snobbery and that his class origins coloured the way people interpreted his contribution to public life.
Yeah, I think that was pretty unfair of John. You know, the two Jaguars and everything else. Look, he wanted for other people what he also felt was right for him and his family. And I think the great thing about John was not that he had two Jaguars, but he wanted everybody to have the chance of a high level of prosperity. And he would judge and measure by what effect it would have on working people. And of course, in government, you make mistakes, you do certain things wrong, you've got to correct things, the disagreements and everything else. But at the end of the day, I don't think we should forget that the reason that we're talking about the environment at the moment, the reason that the regions, even the idea of levelling up became a common idea of the Conservatives, and the reason that people talk about the state of the housing market, these were John's contributions as Environment Secretary to put all these issues on the map in a new way.
You never know someone really from their public persona, from their public profile. You'll be aware of that more than most. What was John Prescott like in private? What was he like in person?
Warm, friendly. Would always say what he thought, but he wouldn't do it in a vicious and an angry way. And, you know, I've talked to John over these last few months when he had declining health. And what was amazing about the way he dealt with his Alzheimer, he always knew who you were, but wasn't sure about what to say. But it was the warmth. He was praising everybody. You've done a great job. I look back on things and say, what a wonderful team we've been and everything else. That was John. I think he even made up with Peter Mandelson in the last few months. So I think it just shows the reconciliations that were possible. But the warmth that flew from talking to John, it was quite amazing in these last few months. So I obviously Alzheimer's is a terrible thing, but he never lost this warmth and friendliness, which he showed at all times in private conversation. He could be very blunt. He could tell you were wrong. He could tell you that you disagreed entirely. He could tell you, I'm going to go out and attack you. But in private conversations, there was a warmth that people never quite saw, because they saw him as a trade unionist with uncompromising toughness, when in fact he was gentle and generous in real life. And I do think this morning of Pauline's widow, who stood by him right throughout all these difficult times, when I don't think she wanted the national publicity, but she was incredibly loyal to John, as were his sons.
Final thought. You mentioned what the Labour Party owes him. What do you think Britain owes John Prescott?
Britain, you know, has difficulties with social mobility. Britain has got this image around the world of an aristocratic and still unreformed and sometimes deferential and hierarchical society. John broke through all this. John gave people who were starting from low-income backgrounds the sense that they could actually achieve something and achieve something right to the point of Deputy Prime Minister. And something that Angela Rayner talks about now, to her great credit, that she made it through all the difficulties that she faced in her early life. And we've got to hold to this idea that people from whatever the background, whatever the race, whatever the religion, have got the chance to do great things. And everybody's got a potential to do that.
Gordon Brown, very good to talk to you. Thank you. Well, that was Gordon Brown, former Prime Minister, of course. He mentioned Lord Mandelson in the last few minutes. Lord Mandelson has issued a short statement about John Prescott. He says, John Prescott was one of the all-time greats of the Labour Party. We owed so much to him, his determination, his courage, his loyalty. He was the cement that kept New Labour together, a massive force for good, as well as a tremendous personality.
24 minutes past eight. We can now get an update on the sport, because Mike Williams has just joined us again. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Emma. Let's start with a question. Which team currently has the best record in the whole of British professional football? The answer is Chelsea Women. They have played 11, won 11 in all competitions so far this season. A 100% record, better than any other team, men's or women's, in all the professional leagues up and down the country. Chelsea's latest victory came last night in the Champions League, a 3-0 win over Celtic that has seen them reach the quarterfinals with two games to spare. Let's speak to the former England midfielder Izzy Christensen, who joins us live on the programme. Morning, Izzy.
Very good morning.
What about this Chelsea side then? They are just steamrolling everyone in their path at the moment.
That's right. They're looking like a well-oiled machine right now. And they are in their early stages of their new management reign with Sonia Bompastor, who is the former Lyon coach. And Lyon are the most successful women's Champions League club with 8 titles. So I think you can guess which way Chelsea want to go this season in the Champions League.
Yeah, and you mentioned there, a lot of the credit has to go to Chelsea's new manager, doesn't it? The Frenchwoman Sonia Bompastor. On early evidence, she is making Chelsea even more of a formidable side than they were under Emma Hayes, which you have to say is a pretty ominous prospect for the rest of the league.
It was going to be fascinating to see how Sonia Bompastor came in and how she took over the reins from, like you say, such a successful manager in Emma Hayes. But she's done it, and she's done it in her own way. And they are looking like a team who I don't think they're beatable at the moment. I really don't. I think the form and the football that they're playing, they've got an answer for everything. And they got a huge win at the weekend, last weekend against Manchester City, their title rivals, at Stamford Bridge. And then they've backed it up last night, like you say, with a really convincing win over Celtic in the Champions League. So, yeah, they're flying high at the moment.
Yeah, 7 out of 7 in the Women's Super League, where they currently sit top of the pile, and 4 out of 4 in the Champions League, as we say, through to the quarterfinals. Manchester City, meanwhile, can join Chelsea in the last 8 with a win this evening. They are away to the Swedish side, Hammarby. Your old side, Izzy, Manchester City, they should get the job done tonight, shouldn't they?
They should do, but it'll be tough. I think that Hammarby have a really good coach. They're very well organised. They came over to Manchester last week on a really bitterly cold night. I was at the game and they brought 600 fans with them. It was just the most incredible atmosphere, one of the best I've ever seen at a women's game. So I imagine Manchester City will experience the same again, but in greater mass tonight over in Stockholm. So hopefully my old club can get it done, but it won't be a smooth ride, I'm sure.
Yeah, those Hammarby Ultras are a real force in women's football, aren't they? I was looking at videos of them last week, bringing the atmosphere to Manchester. And a final word on Arsenal. Izzy, they're taking on Juventus in North London later this evening. I know that you are going to be covering this game for the BBC. Arsenal also will all but make it through to the quarterfinals with a win over the Italians this evening. And that would be pretty impressive, because their league form, Arsenal, hasn't been so decisive this season.
That's right, they've had a very interesting start to the season, but since René Slegers, who is the interim coach, has taken charge of the team, it's a little bit unknown as to whether she'll stay till the end of the season, whether she's going to take over permanently. But right now she is doing a terrific job, and the way that Arsenal are playing at the moment, they are looking really smooth. They're starting to gather some momentum. And of course, Juventus are a very, very good European side. They're still not probably quite where they want to be, but 4-0 in the away leg last week to Arsenal. So they'll be coming to the Emirates tonight with a lot of confidence. But I think they have to be wary of the threat that Juventus pose, which is quite an unpredictable one.
Yeah, things looking good so far for the British sides in the Women's Champions League. And as we say, you can hear coverage of Arsenal against Juventus with regular updates of Manchester City away to Hammarby as well on 5 Live Sport this evening from 8 p.m. Izzy Christensen there, former England midfielder. Many thanks for your time.
Mike, thanks very much. Melvyn Bragg will be here with In Our Time later this morning. Let's hear the details.
Good morning. We'll be talking about the Italian novelist Italo Calvino, an influential figure in 20th century world literature. After fighting with the partisans in the Second World War, he turned in peacetime to writing as a way to celebrate humanity, keeping realism at arm's length to make space for the imagination, and wrote novels marked by the fantastical, such as Barons Living in Trees, A Viscount Thriving Though Cut in Two, and perhaps his best-known work, Invisible Cities, having Marco Polo tell Kublai Khan of wondrous places that neither of them had ever seen. That's Italo Calvino with Guido Bonsever, Jennifer Burns and Beatrice Seeker on Radio 4 and on BBC Sounds just after 9 o'clock. Now back to today.
Thank you, Melvyn. Quick look at the weather. Dry and bright for most today, but scattered sleet and snow showers in the northwest and north. Cloudier for southwest England and far southern Wales.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. It is 29 minutes past 8, and we can now have a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
The former Deputy Prime Minister Lord Prescott, a major figure in the Labour Party for several decades, has died at the age of 86. His family said he had been living with Alzheimer's. Sir Tony Blair, in whose government Lord Prescott spent a decade as Deputy Prime Minister, said he was devastated and called him one of the most talented people he'd ever encountered in politics. Gordon Brown told this programme that while people perceived John Prescott to be uncompromisingly tough, he was a gentleman and generous in real life. Government borrowing rose to £17.4 billion last month, marking the second highest October figure since monthly records began. The Office for National Statistics said public sector net borrowing was £1.6 billion higher than the same month last year. The water industry regulator Ofwat says 9 companies will be stopped from using customer money to pay £6.8 million to its top executives in what it called undeserved bonuses. Thames Water, Yorkshire Water and Dŵr Cymru Welsh Water were directly blocked using new powers given to Ofwat. The other 6 volunteered and got shareholders to pay the money.
Jane, thank you very much. It's 8:30. Australia's Parliament has started debating what it calls world-first legislation to restrict children under the age of 16 from accessing social media platforms such as Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat and TikTok. The new legislation needs to pass both houses before it becomes law. The social media companies will then have at least a year to come up with solutions to prevent children from getting on their platforms, otherwise facing fines of as much as £26 million. Would the UK government be open to implementing such a ban for under 16s? Here's my exchange with the Technology Secretary, Peter Kyle, on this issue on yesterday's programme. Just a quick thing here, which many are mooting, an Australian-style ban on social media for under 16s. Will you do that?
Everything is on the table with me.
What does that mean?
Into the future. Well, what I want to do is look at the evidence.
So we don't know yet what would happen here, but it's on the table. Tony Allen, Chief Executive and Founder of the Age Check Certification Scheme, a British body which has been chosen by the Australian government to run a trial of age assurance technology, is on the line. And in a moment, I'll come to somebody who has worked at both Twitter and Instagram for their take, which is important to get. But Tony, good morning. Can this work? Is it possible to have robust enough age verification in place?
Good morning, Emma. Yes, we've been selected by the Australian government to actually find that exactly that point is to test it, to look at the various different methodologies of age assurance, age verification, age estimation, age inference, parental consent, parental controls, all of those aspects, and look at how they work and where they work and where they can be deployed for best, whether it's on the device or as a part of a process of signing up for an account. This is all part of the programme of activity that the Australian government have commissioned from us.
So you're looking into it, but we don't know yet, because there have been other issues around age verification. For instance, it was looked at here in the UK and then didn't go forward around porn.
Well, you're absolutely right. Back in 2017, the UK passed a piece of legislation, Digital Economy Act, tried to bring it in. Actually, probably, to be fair, didn't think it through properly. Went away, had another go at it, and we've got the Online Safety Act, and that actually comes into force in the UK here in January. So it's a much more nuanced and much better thought out piece of legislation than was around 2017. Mm. It still has challenges, issues, but it's considerably better thought out. The guidance from Ofcom, which has they've been working on, is very detailed and very analysed.
I suppose it's just, if you're thinking about, we'll get to sort of the kind of moral side of this, the educational side of this, just thinking about if it will actually work. Some of the issues around privacy, isn't it? The idea that you don't want these companies to have the type of information that you might need to make an age verification system work. For instance, the type of thing you need to do with when you're setting up a financial account. You know, you don't want them to have things like ID or whatever it is, birth certificates.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, the privacy is front and centre. And actually, the privacy issue is one of the reasons why the legislation from 2017 I was just talking about wasn't really thought through properly. But it has been thought through quite well now. And so the international standard ISO 27566 has five key aspects to it. Does the age assurance system work? Is it functional? How does it perform? What level of accuracy is it? Privacy, making sure that it's private, it's privacy preserving, it doesn't add to your digital footprint. Security, can it be spoofed? Can you get around it? Are there ways around it? And accessibility and acceptability. So is it inclusive? Is there a right of redress? Those sorts of things. They're all part and parcel of a much more advanced standardised regime now.
And just getting an older sibling to set it up for you or a friend, you think you can block that?
Well, none of them are foolproof, and there's no one-size-fits-all, and there's no silver bullet. There's no single system that will... What you've got to do is you've got to identify the risk, and then you have to put an appropriate tool into that risk. Now, we all know, if we go into a gun shop to buy a gun, we expect to go through quite a degree of friction in doing that, because we are very clear what that risk is. One of the problems you have with the modern digital world is sometimes it's quite unclear why the risk is there. There's lots of research and lots of people go, oh, well, you could have this or it could be that. But if you're not, if consumers and users aren't able to see the risk, they aren't able to assimilate the reason why they're being asked to prove their age. If they can see the risk, it's much easier.
I suppose that's about, and let me bring in at this point Sunil Singhvi, former manager at Twitter and Instagram. Good morning.
Good morning.
I think that's about repositioning these platforms then, that they are a risk. I wonder, I mean, first of all, what do you make of what Australia is doing?
So I think directionally, it's the right thing to do. I think it's the right thing to do is to have a conversation about what age is it appropriate for you to see user-generated content en masse, at what stage in your life. I do think that the notion of a ban is probably a quite old school version of how to resolve this challenge.
So what would you prefer if it's directionally the correct way?
I think that it has to be multifaceted. I think there has to be a greater look at education. There has to be a greater look, as your previous guest just mentioned, at understanding the problem and what actually is the problem. Is it that this is a time drain and that people spend too much time on it? Or is it exposure to content that perhaps is inappropriate to audiences? And I think there's lots of different reasons that are all being packaged into one. The other thing that I would say is that this technology moves incredibly quickly. So the things that were being discussed in 2017 are not the same challenges today. And I think the pressure on the tech platforms across the board, you know, Twitter and Instagram and all these companies, is to keep moving with the time, to keep putting new features and new safeguards in place and not wait for government regulation, which I think is going to take far, far too long.
But I suppose also this idea of us thinking of these platforms as dangerous for young people. You know, there's been a lot of concern around education and whether we're up to date on that and how to, you know, how to safely go on there. But are we at the point where you just can't safely go on there as a young person? Because, you know, not least we know some of the research around the impact specifically of Instagram on young girls.
I don't think that is a complete the complete case that it's not safe for any young person. I think there's a huge amount of evidence that says niche communities and people that do feel outside of the mainstream find their voices, find their identities much easier online than they would do in real life. And I think it can become a huge support system to people that are trying to find out about, you know, where they fit into a wider world and a more connected world. So I don't think it's a case of saying, gosh, as soon as you open an app, then this is going to be disastrous for you and there's no coming back from it. But I do think there are smart ways to do it. And I think interesting to see Instagram this week rolling out a reset the algorithm function, which I think is actually incredibly smart, that actually you could be in a position where you go, I'm starting to see content that doesn't feel right for me. I'm starting to feel content that feels like I might not enjoy it anymore. And being able to tell the machine, tell the algorithm, this is not where I want to head. This is not what I want to see anymore, and return to, you know, dog videos and football content or whatever it is that you want to see. So I think moves like that are the important move. The blanket ban, we've had blanket bans on cigarettes and alcohol for years and years. It doesn't mean that no one under 16 has ever touched one of those products in the UK.
Sunil Singhvi, former manager at Twitter and Instagram, Tony Allen, and the chief executive and founder of the Age Check Certification Scheme. Thank you.
It's 21 minutes to nine.
Last month, Steve Reid, the Environment Secretary, said as the government launched a new independent review of the water sector, and I quote, "If we had better regulation, I don't think the water sector would be in the state that it is in today," adding that oversight has not been robust enough. Well, that oversight has fallen to and still falls to the regulator, Ofwat, which today releases a report into executive pay and the resilience of water firms. The crucial headline from it, 9 water companies will not be able to pay for bosses' bonuses from the money that they receive from their customers. With David Black, the chief executive of Ofwat, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Who will be paying for those bonuses?
Investors. So what we've announced today is that we've stepped in to stop water customers paying for chief executive bonuses where they're not justified by performance for customers and the environment. And as a result of that, 73% of bonuses in the sector will be paid for by investors, not customers.
Because, I mean, if you look at this, Labour analysis earlier this year found water company bosses have received over £25 million in bonuses and incentives since 2019. Should anyone have been receiving a bonus during that time?
So we are very clear that bonuses need to be linked to performance for customers and the environment. We've got new powers, and so this is the first year we've had these new powers. So we have intervened. We've been clear in the past that we think bonuses have been paid where they haven't been earned by chief executives. And so today is our action to...
Why didn't you get these powers sooner?
We didn't have the ability to intervene when water company bonuses prior to this year.
No, but why didn't you ask for these powers sooner? It was clear the writing was on the wall. Some would say the horse has already bolted.
So we received powers under the Environment Act 2021 to change company licences, which gives us the ability to set rules around executive pay. We've taken this...
I accept that. Why didn't you push for it sooner? You've been at this organisation for some time, as have others around you.
I've been chief executive since 2022, and so we...
How long have you been in Ofwat?
So I've been in this role since 2022.
No, I know, but I was looking back through. My point is, it's just trying to get a sense of this has been like this for some time. You are about to get more powers as well. That's right to say, isn't it?
So there's a bill before Parliament which would give us powers to stop companies paying executive bonuses where they haven't been earned, and that's so yes.
So on that power, how radical are you going to be? For instance, until sewage leaks stop, should any water boss get a bonus in this country?
So we'll look at what Parliament, the rules that Parliament sets. And then we are consulting, and we've already consulted actually on how we're going to take forward those new powers. And so, for example, we'd propose to intervene where companies were breaking the law and where their performance wasn't delivering on the responsibilities that they've been given. So in terms of sewage discharges, it's important to distinguish between those that are illegal, which we're taking enforcement action on alongside the Environment Agency, and those that are currently permitted within the law. And so where sewage discharges are illegal, we would expect bonuses not to be paid.
If you've consulted already, how radical are you going to be then? So if there is an illegal sewage leak, will you stop a boss from getting a bonus that year should you get those powers?
The provisions that we've been consulting on, and I would stress this is a consultation, would be that where companies do not, you know, where they break the law, bonuses wouldn't be paid, yes.
Okay, so that you are willing to go there should you get those powers? Because I suppose when we're looking through what you know, our listeners care about, higher bills, poor customer service, and illegal sewage leaks, not least what had happened in Windermere, you know, in October, United Utilities repeatedly dumped millions of litres of raw sewage into one of our most famous lakes, England's most famous lakes. United Utilities said some of it was potentially, some of those releases were potentially non-compliant, but it self-reported over 94%. But that, with that whole report can be looked into. You know, people do not feel, as they're paying more, that they're getting better value, and then they see stories like that.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely vital that the sector rebuilds trust of customers. It has lost the trust of customers through actions like paying executive bonuses where they haven't been justified, where companies have been behaving illegally, which is why that we have introduced the changes that we've had the power to do so, to stop customers paying for water company bonuses, and why the government is consulting on new powers for us to take further action.
Do you accept people don't trust Ofwat, though?
I accept that the sector isn't trusted, and I think that applies to both regulators and to water companies.
So it's a job to do to rebuild.
Yes,
that
trust. We're very clear that we need to regulate differently. We are regulating differently. That's why we've brought in new powers to crack down on executive pay.
It's just good to get a sense of where you're going with that, because just in terms of away from pay into bills and what people are paying out, we're about a month away from you determining just how much water companies can raise their bills. Can we expect them to rise even further than predicted back in July?
Yes, we think there has been upward pressure on bills since our draft decisions in July. So these include new investment requirements coming from the Environment Agency and the Drinking Water Inspectorate. And we expect to receive evidence, or companies have provided evidence about why their costs are higher than what we've been at draft determinations. We haven't yet decided what these amounts will be.
So our listeners can expect to pay more for their water, so more than we had been expected.
We think it's quite likely that there will be upward pressure on bills from draft determinations.
How can you justify that?
So what we are backing is a huge increase in investment. So we need to see transformation in the sector. We need to see more investment. That's part of it. We also need to see a change in culture and an improvement in performance.
So are you going to not insist on those higher bills until those things are met? For instance, if you've had terrible customer service from your water company and then your bill's going to go up next year and the regulator has signed that off...
So we will fund, we will back investment which is required by government in the you know, both in wastewater and new water resources. So we're talking about building new water reservoirs. We're talking about improving the sewage treatment works. We're talking about cracking down on storm overflow. So there's a lot of work to be done. That does need new investment under the model for the sector. This is
funded. So higher bills are justified?
This is, some increase in bills is justified. We will push back on bill increases, which we think, well, they haven't been justified. justified, where companies are seeking to either raise returns or excessively, or to impose costs on customers which have not been justified. That's our role. But where the government is requiring companies to invest more, then we will allow them the efficient costs of doing so. That will increase cost of bills. At the same time, our regime automatically penalises companies for poor customer service.
It was just when you hear the environment, the new environment secretary say that regulation and oversight, which you're in charge of, hasn't been robust enough. How do you expect our listeners to trust you that you're going to do a good enough job at delineating between the companies that are doing a good enough job to raise the bills and those who are not?
So I think the Secretary of State's referring to the entire regulatory framework, which includes environmental regulation.
It does, but it includes Ofwat, yes, of which you are chief exec.
Which is why we have changed how we're regulating, and we'll carry on holding companies to account. We have stepped in to protect customers' interests. We will continue to do so. And the announcement today in terms of blocking chief executive bonuses from being recovered from customers is part of that.
David Black, chief executive of Ofwat. Thank you.
14 minutes to nine. As ever, huge choice of audio options for you on the BBC after the Today programme here on Radio 4 at 9 o'clock, or just after the news at 9 o'clock. It's in our time. Or if you'd rather something completely different, we have launched a new music stream. It's called Radio 3 Unwind. And to listen, you can just go to the BBC Sounds app and tap on Radio 3 Unwind, or on your smart speaker, you can say play Radio 3 Unwind. Unwind, and life will get infinitely better for all involved.
We both need that now, don't we?
Yeah, this time of the morning, always. But before we unwind with Radio 3, let's reflect a bit more on the extraordinary life and legacy of John Prescott, with one man who followed him for, I think, Nick, the best part of 15 years. Nick Robinson, who's not working quite hard enough this week in Europe covering migration, has phoned in to give us some of the reflections. I mean, there's one very famous clip which we'll come to in a moment, Nick, but first of all, we should just assess, given you were there in the room and talking to him regularly, what he contributed, Nick, to New Labour.
Yeah, good morning from Vienna Airport. I'm on my way to present the programme from Berlin tomorrow, Emil. Yeah, I was struck as I heard the news early this morning about how significant John Prescott was. We'll come to the fun, we'll come to the comedy that he shared in, I might say, in a moment. But let's remember his importance. He was the shield for Tony Blair. He was the salesman for Tony Blair. He was, in many ways, the conscience for Tony Blair. He made it possible for a middle-class boy who'd gone to Scotland's top public school, Fettes, who was the son of an aspiring Conservative MP, a man who prided himself in being the friend of the wealthy and the successful. He made it possible for that man, Tony Blair, to lead the Labour Party to three election victories. Why? Well, because he was Northern, he was working class, he was fiercely proud of his trade union background, but he talked of traditional values in a modern setting. And therefore, he was in many ways the Labour in New Labour, making it possible for Blair to do things that just a year or two before would have been thought of as impossible.
Well, he got one big thing wrong, Nick, because he said in an interview in 2019, and I quote, "When I do die after 50 years in politics, all they will show on the news is 60 seconds of me thumping a fellow in Wales." And that was a reference to the 2001 punch where a farmer threw an egg at him and he very quickly threw one back. But there was another, I mean, there's so many clips, there's so much fantastic archive, but there was one which, you know, a lot of us saw before we knew you, Nick, which is an interaction you could say was never dull and certainly was live.
It's certainly true. Let me just tell you about the punch very briefly. The next day, many people thought John Prescott's career was over. I mean, he thumped someone in the middle of an election campaign. And Tony Blair came with a rehearsed line to the election news conference. He said, "John will be John." And I, frankly, rather pompously in my question to him as BBC political editor at the time, no, I in fact was chief political correspondent at the time, said to him, to the Prime Minister, "You sound a bit like a mother of a thug outside a magistrate's court." Well, you know what? I was wrong and he was right. The public did think John will be John. They thought, unlike most politicians, he was himself. He was like them. He was an ordinary guy. And if they'd been punched, they probably would have wanted to punch back. It didn't do him any damage at all, nor did the fact that he often stumbled on his words. He quite often got into a tangle. And on one occasion that has been oft played on programmes, and we're going to hear in just a second. I was interviewing John Prescott for what used to be called News 24, the 24-hour news channel, which he just got ever so slightly into a mess with his words.
Bear in mind that something like 70 to 80% of the actual demand are single-parent households or single youngsters or people who are living in a single house. Can you do that again? I made that crap.
We're live at the moment, Mr. Prescott. Will you agree to do that?
What you can't see, and I could at the time, is the big grin on John Prescott's face that he just said, I made that crap, on live television. And afterwards, we continued to try and have a sensible conversation about young single households or whatever it was. And as soon as the camera was off, we wept with laughter. And the joy of John Prescott was he was always fun. And even when he got his words in a tangle, people knew exactly what he meant. He was an accidentally brilliant communicator.
Nick Robinson from Vienna Airport on his way to Berlin, where he'll be presenting this programme from tomorrow. As ever, very good to talk to you, Nick, and get those reflections on the life of John Prescott. And we're going to have a bit more of that before the end of the programme now.
Tributes have been paid throughout the morning. I'm sure they'll continue to do so. We heard from Sir Tony Blair. We've heard from Gordon Brown. And actually on that relationship, in 2012, he spoke to Kirsty Young on Desert Island Discs about how he often acted as what he called a marriage counsellor between Blair and Brown.
I was well aware that both of them were brilliant, quite frankly. Gordon in the economics, Tony in the politics, in a way. And we needed them. I had to keep these two horses going in the same direction. When it got really difficult, I'd have them in for a meal, and I'd sit in the middle, and Gordon on one side, Tony on the other. And Gordon, you know, could be a miserable bugger from time to time. He'd sit on, this chair's a bit low. You know, and I said, oh, as my waiter experience, I'll get you another chair. So I got him a higher chair, turned to Tony and said, do you want a higher chair, Tony? No, I'm used to Gordon looking down at me. So to that extent, I had to manage that and go in there. And I think they were both brilliant. I'm an admirer of both.
There you go. That's how marriage counselling works of Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, both of whom we've had on the programme this morning. Lord Michael Heseltine was Deputy Prime Minister under John Major, former MP for Henley, former Conservative MP, of course. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And we also have Alan Johnson on the line, former Labour Home Secretary and MP for Kingston upon Hull West and Hessel. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
If I come to you first, Lord Heseltine, what are you thinking of this morning as we learn the news of John Prescott's passing?
Well, I'm delighted that you've asked me to participate, because I think I can tell you of a story which will surprise many people. And of course, if John was at the forefront of the battleground on behalf of Labour in the 70s and 80s, I was perhaps very much on the other side of the conflict. But about 10 years ago, the Heseltine Institute, part of Liverpool University, did a programme about my life. And it's extraordinary, but John Prescott came all the way from London just to participate in that programme. And I remember what he said. He said, the thing about Michael and I is we both started at the extreme end. I came from the working class, state-educated, trade union world of politics. And he came from a leading public school, prosperous middle class, Tory. And here we are. We've met in the middle ground. And we share the concern that he showed in the work that he did in Liverpool. And I thought that was a remarkable tribute for someone who had come from so much the other end of the political scale.
It is. And I suppose that's why it's important for you to talk this morning on the news that we have heard. And it's important, I suppose, in politics, Alan, to bring you in at this point to hear from those on the other side of the aisle, because you go through a lot and you're often fighting for different things, but for the same reasons. What are you thinking of this morning with your connections to John Prescott?
Well, I was so pleased to hear Michael say what he said, and John would have been delighted, because they were more similar than they thought they were. Michael Heseltine and John Prescott both had an absolutely passionate belief that you should devolve power down, that local government was important. I remember Michael's report, No Stone Unturned, when Michael came to Hull, where I was also
had the privilege to be an MP, and it aligned so much with what John Prescott tried to do in government. And I say tried, he succeeded at most, but he really wanted to go a step further with regional development agencies and have an elected mayor and all of that. And he couldn't achieve that, but he achieved so much in that devolution area that I think it made him a kindred spirit of Michael. And Michael's point there also showed that whereas many people's first description of John was uncompromising, like most trade union officials, he spent his whole life finding compromises and finding settlements. It wasn't about taking workers out on strike. It was convincing them to go back because you had the right deal. So I think Michael summed up there in a way that would have delighted John.
Yeah, well,
his life's work.
But I was also going to say, you know, he was at pains during his life to say he didn't want to be remembered just for the punch. His pride was his constituency, which you can very much talk to, can't you, Alan Johnson?
Yes, he was East Hull, I was West Hull. He's Hull Kingston Rovers, I'm Hull FC, two divided by a river and by rugby league. But John was passionate. He came here, and I speak in Hull now, he came here to attend a university and study economics and got a master's degree at Hull University, loved the place and stayed here till the end. You know, he was dedicated because Hull summed up John's approach. Plain speaking, what you saw was what you got, and they never, ever patronised or said things that were meant to just butter you up. That was John all over. So he loved the city and the city loved him.
Lord Heseltine, good morning. It's Amol Rajan here. I just wanted to ask you about one particular aspect of John Prescott's politics. We often have this very reductive view of people in public life and cast him as just this, you know, working class trade union guy. But he did believe in public investment. And in a way, he actually continued your political philosophy of investing in infrastructure. So where you were responsible for the Channel Tunnel and HS1, he picked up that very particular baton and quite literally ran with it.
Well, I remember sharing the one of the celebrations of HS1 with John. We went on the same train to the same celebration. And so he really continued and completed the work that I had begun. But I'm very interested in Alan's remarks about the mayoral devolution, because John would have, I think, shared Alan and my view that we've now got mayors in about half the country in the large urban areas. And the challenge for this government is actually to complete the pattern. And I hope very much in the white paper that they're about to produce, they will go for unitary counties with mayoral elections. It would be a major devolution step in the pursuit of growth.
Lord Heseltine, I was also just interested how it was being on a train with John Prescott on the way to a party, or partying on a train with him. Any good memories of that, Lord Heseltine?
Well, John and I, it'd be ridiculous to say we were close friends, because, you know, that's not the way of politics. But we got on very well. And once you got away from the political spotlight and the need to sort of make sure that your followers are on side, it, as so often with the Labour leaders I worked with in the urban areas, we had a lot in common and a very deep commitment to trying to improve the conditions of the people who lived in these very difficult circumstances.
Alan Johnson, that aspiration has also come through this morning, what he felt about, you know, bettering people's lives and them wanting more for themselves and their families.
Yes, and much of what he did was under the bonnet, and it didn't show up, it didn't make headlines. The Right to Roam was a John Prescott initiative when he was in that huge department. What he did for British shipping, what he did for decent home standards in terms of council housing, all of those things John largely did without recognition.